be merciful unto us and bless us, and cause his face to shine upon us, that thy way may be known upon earth, thy saving help among all nations. Let the people
everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, August 22nd, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140, and our participation code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send it to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab up on the top right side of our webpage. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be out of the Gospel of John, chapter 3, verses 1 through 21. So that's John, chapter 3, verses 1 through 21. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. The same came to Jesus by night and said unto him, Rabbi, we know that thou art a teacher come from God, and no man can do these miracles that thou doest, except God be with him. Jesus answered and said unto him, Truly, truly, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Nicodemus saith unto him, How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter the second time into his mother's womb and be born? Jesus answered, Truly, truly, I say unto thee, except a man be born of water and of spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, that which is born of the spirit is spirit. Marvel not that I say unto thee, ye must be born again. The wind bloweth where it listeneth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh or whither it goeth. So is everyone that is born of the Spirit. Nicodemus saith unto him, how can these things be? Jesus answered and said unto him, art thou a master of Israel, and knowest not these things? Truly, truly, I say unto thee, we speak that we do know, and testify that we have seen, and ye receive not our witness. If I had told you earthly things, and ye believe not, how shall ye believe if I tell you heavenly things? And no man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that come down from heaven, even the Son of Man, which is in heaven. And as if Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He that believeth on him is not condemned, but he that believeth not is condemned already, because he hath not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of the God. And this is the condemnation, that light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For every one that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth cometh to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest, that they are wrought in God. Okay, that was John chapter 3, verses 1 through 21. Okay, tonight we got a couple of different things we're going to be looking at and talking about. We have entered into the courts as of today into Oregon. We've filed some papers with the court, four papers as a matter of fact. Up on our website, if anybody wants to go out there and click on the blue bar, the far right-hand side, grand jury, that's nationalliberty.org, blue bar, all the way to the right, says grand jury. This is a new page. We put the page up a couple of weeks ago, but there really hasn't been anything up there until this past weekend. We uploaded on this page all of the cases that we're working on, and we tried to break it up in such a way that they're easy to find. The first case on the top is the USA against Bundy, ETL, and that et al. That's the Wildlife Preserve case, and that's the case that we filed today. We filed four papers into the court today. We had in the past filed a habeas corpus. We defaulted that habeas corpus, and we gave them an opportunity to amend, and they haven't responded. We have checked the dockets. They have not filed on the dockets. So we then sent a concealment letter to the clerk, which we may read tonight. We've got four papers. That was one of them. The other one was a memorandum of jurisdiction. Now, a memorandum of jurisdiction is a really important paper, and I'm going to save that for next week. It's about 10 pages, and I do want to read that paper. People will have the opportunity during the week to read that paper, and next week we'll read it online here, and we'll talk a little bit about it, maybe take some questions on it. But you have to establish your jurisdiction when you go into a court, and people are welcome to use this memorandum of jurisdiction. But you need to understand how to use it and what to do with it, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. But the key thing here is really the truth of the fact of the jurisdiction and the clear-cut information that we've really put together onto this memorandum of law. The other paper we wrote and we filed into the courts today was a motion to release. There are, I believe, 15 defendants still in jail. Some of them have been released. They've pleaded out, and I think there are some that have been released. Well, I know there are some that's been released, and they're waiting for also a court date. They have moved the court date for some of these individuals that are out to February 2017. I forget what day in February, but February. So they're giving them more time. The Bundys did request more time. They wanted the case to be pushed out. The judge ignored it and kept the court date for, let's see, I think it's September, I think, 8th or the 7th or something like that. They started choosing a jury, and they've called 1,500 people up in order to make sure that they get the right jury. You know, it's a stacked jury, of course. And they've given to this stacked jury the jury questionnaire, which, by the way, we will probably file a copy of that jury questionnaire up somewhere, probably on this page here. I know I have it on my computer. I've looked at this before. We're going to be studying this jury questionnaire, and we're going to show you the absurdity and the psychology games that they're playing and how they stack the courts with this, and we're also going to file some papers concerning that. And the fact that they've called 1,500 people to try to find 12 people is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Are we the people that dumb that we don't realize what they are doing? That we don't look at, you don't get to choose a jury the way that they choose the jury. You don't get to ask them questions. If you think that they're a problem for the jury, you ask them straight out. And if they answer in such a way that they're a problem, maybe they know the individual or something, or maybe they're prejudiced against that individual for whatever reason, okay, you get rid of that person. But you don't get the chance to decide whether they're watching CNN or Fox News, or whether they watch some kind of a cop show or no cop shows, or what kind of TV programs they watch. And I mean, these are the questions that they ask on this, in these questionnaires, okay? And again, we're going to post that questionnaire. And this is repugnant to everything that's good. It's repugnant to anything that's just. And so anyway, this is what they're doing out there, and we filed our papers. They won't receive them till probably Thursday, okay? So it's going to be a while before they get it. Meanwhile, we're going to file some more papers, and we're going to be talking about this problem that they have with the juries, and also the fact that the Bundys and the other individuals involved here have every right to take all the time they need to prepare a case for themselves. They are not ready for court, but this judge just does not care. Now, we're waiting for affidavits concerning this problem, and without those affidavits, we're not going to really be able to make a good argument other than just an argument without the affidavits. And look, I don't like to file anything or make any argument without some kind of a documentation. Affidavits is the key of a court. There's nothing takes nothing more than an affidavit to have a prima facie case. You don't have to know how to fill a paper out, work out. You don't have to know the process and the motions and all that stuff. All you have to do is have a good affidavit, a sworn affidavit. That's all you need, and get in there and argue the facts. That's common law. Okay. Now, it is true, you should know the court procedures and the rules and the processes, and there's nothing wrong with that. And if you're getting in there battling the government, you should understand and know the codes involved with that. Shame on us if we don't take the time to learn. You don't need 4 years or 6 years in college to become a lawyer to know these things. You can get this done in a couple of months. You can understand the process and the procedures and learn the court rules. It's pretty simple. It doesn't take a rocket scientist. It doesn't take a heavy education. It just takes someone who's a thinker. That's all it takes. Someone who can think. That's all it takes. Okay? Can you think? Then you could do it. But to go into a court without understanding how the process works and trying to make an argument is very silly. Forget about it. Don't even try it. And don't go in with the fiction, the man on the land stuff, because they're going to crucify you. They're going to laugh at you. And if you really piss them off, they're going to put you in jail. They'll get you for contempt or something. But you're not going to win your case. Certainly not that way. Okay, they'll say you're crazy. They'll get a psychiatrist, and they'll muzzle you, and they'll force a lawyer upon you, and you won't be able to say a darn thing in court at all. If that's what you want, then you go talk about the man on the land in their court. Anybody who thinks that they can go and do those things and click their heels and they're going to be delivered out of fantasy land, I got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you, because it's just not going to happen. Please don't do that. You're wasting your time, and you're only putting yourself in harm's way. Learn the processes. Learn common law. Learn what works. Find out what rules. Understand jurisdiction, okay, and understand due process. Understand the Bill of Rights. Understand your unalienable rights. And judge everything. Everything is measured by your unalienable right. Anything that comes up, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a code, whether it's a court ruling, or whatever they want to bring up, you take out your ruler. It's called your unalienable rights, and you lay it alongside that. And if it violates your unalienable rights in any way, it's null and void, and that's the end of the subject. There's nothing more to discuss. And we got to make this clear in court, because that's the logic and that's the process. But anyway, people need to learn. If people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. You know, it's not going to happen. So let's learn what needs to be done. Okay, anyway, we did file some papers. I want to quickly go through them, I think. I think I'm going to read them. They're very short. One's 3 pages, and most of it's footnotes, and I'm not going to read the footnotes anyway, so it's really less than 2 pages, maybe. The first paper we're going to read and file is a motion for an order of protection. Let me just go back, and I don't know if I mentioned them all. We filed with the court a memorandum jurisdiction, motion to release, and a motion of protection, an order for protection. We also filed, served on to the clerk a concealment letter, which we never read that. It's the last one, and that's a very short one also. But let's read this one first, a motion for order of protection and notice to the grand jury investigation. Comes now the Unified United States. Well, first off, we have the USA, which are the plaintiffs, against Bundy et al., which are the defendants. We set up the jurisdiction up on the top right-hand side of the paper, which we put down jurisdiction, court of record, under the rules of common law. Again, you can download these papers and read along with us if you want. Click on the grand jury bar, top right-hand side, and you'll see the Bundy case, which is the wildlife preserve, and you'll see these papers. You can click on them and get the PDF copy and read along with it. Okay. So motion for order of protection and notice of grand jury investigation. Okay, we're coming in. The Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury is coming in and proceeding as next friend under Rule 1728 USCA, and I'm going to read that footnote. And that is footnote number 3, a next friend. A next friend is a person who represents someone who is unable to tend to his or her own interests. Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 1728 USCA, Haynes versus Kinnear, and it's got some other numbers and stuff. So that's what a next friend is. Anybody that is imprisoned and cannot represent themselves. And I want to tell you something, so far from what I've seen, even the lawyers are not doing much in the way of bringing evidence into the court. Now, I just got a message from somebody who told me they got the list of exhibits, and I've been looking for the exhibits, so I'll comment on that more maybe next week if I need to. But anyway, comes now the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, proceeding as next friend in judicial oversight herein after the sureties of the peace under Rule 1728 USCA. To move the court for an order of protection for Ryan and Ammon Bundy and all the defendants from Deputy Sergeant Curtis E. Sanders, Deputy Sergeant Jacob Rose, and Deputy John Doe to be identified. By the way, for those who don't know, they did a beatdown on Ryan about a week or so ago, and I understand, I think he's still in solitary confinement, and Ammon Bundy witnessed this, and he spoke to someone on a telephone and gave them all the information, and we did an affidavit through that process as a next friend, and we attached it to this paperwork. So we have the words of Ammon, and we also have the telephone call itself for the sole purpose of having that necessary documentation of proof. It now has to be rebutted. They have to rebut that, otherwise it stands as fact. And I know these judges ignore it and pass over it, and you know, we're not going to let them ignore it and pass over it. Either you rebut that, because they won't rebut it, because rebutting it, and if they get caught, and there's other witnesses, I'm sure, and they may even turn witnesses against each other, but it doesn't matter. They get in there and lie and forget about it. It's all over for them if they get caught on that. Okay, so their best bet is to be silent, but that makes them guilty, doesn't it? Especially when they have a duty to speak. They're officers. They're officers of the court. They're there with the sheriff's department. They have a duty to speak. Okay. Anyway, I named John Doe's to be identified. Seeing that the court has no lawful reason to detain the defendants, they should be released on their own recognizance under 18 U.S.C. 3142 with the promise to appear for their own protection. See motion to release. So we're going to discuss that in the next one. Atrocities under color of law. The Supreme Court has held that prisoners have a fundamental right to court access, the right to petition for redress of grievances, and the right of due process in courts of law. The Supreme Court has also held in Bevins versus six unknown named agents that when the violation of one's constitutionally protected rights have been violated by federal officers acting under the color of law, prisoners have a right to file action at law for damages under 42 U.S.C. 1983. They also have a right to petition the grand jury to seek criminal charges under 18 U.S.C. 242 for deprivation of rights under the color of law, and they have the unalienable right of habeas corpus petitions, being the very essence of due process that may not be ignored nor denied by any officer for any reason. To do so is high treason. And when officers prevented this right of access through intimidation, harassment, beatdowns, block, and the preparation of filing of lawsuits, refuse to mail legal papers, take away legal research materials, deny access to law books, use solitary confinement and false charges, all in an effort to prevent the pursuit of justice, we the people, through the grand jury, being the sureties of peace, have a duty and a fundamental unalienable right to pursue these cases on our own accord. It is by our consent or not that a court of law may proceed. We the people's untainted trial juries will have the final word, from which there is no appeal. These atrocities are prevalent today, and we clearly see them in the Hammonds case in Oregon, the Bundy's case in Nevada, the Robinson's case in Montana, and also this case in Oregon, to name just a few. We have reports from every state of the Union of these atrocities, not only in the federal courts, but in the state courts, where these tyrants are taking our children for trafficking, our elderly parents for their estates, our homes, and our personal property for RICO, all without due process, in jurisdictions unknown. We, the people, have become prisoners of war. Now, we quoted, Cooper versus Aaron, any judge who does not comply with his oath to the Constitution of the United States wars against the Constitution and engages in acts and in violation of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. Cooper versus Aaron. And we the people, through the sureties of peace, resolutely set our face against these tyrants in courts of justice. Take notice, both the Sheriff's Department and this court are on notice that the sureties of the peace will hold all the officers of this court, Sheriff Michael Reese, Deputy Sergeant Curtis E. Sanders, Deputy Sergeant Jacob Rose, and to be named deputies responsible for any loss of life or limb should this court and Sheriff's Department not respond justly, appropriately, and immediately. Attached is an affidavit of Ammon Bundy by a next friend concerning the beatdown of Ryan Bundy by Deputy Sergeant Curtis E. Sanders and Deputy Sergeant Jacobs, Rose, and two transcripts. We demand investigations by this court and Sheriff Michael Reed, and both are ordered to report to us by fax and mail within 72 hours of receiving this notice, giving us the details and the names of all officers involved and other witnesses. We also demand that Ryan Bundy be released from solitary confinement immediately. Dated today, August 22nd, 2016, signed and sealed by the grand jury foreman. Okay, that was the one paper, again, motion for an order of protection and the notice of a grand jury investigation. The second paper that we filed in the same court, okay, was a motion to release. And let me read that. Again, coming in as the sureties of the peace and proceeding as the next friend under Rule 1728 USCA. Also, the jurisdiction of the court is a court of record, proceeding under the rules of the common law. All of that is shows in the footnotes and so on and so forth. Motion to release under 18 U.S.C. subsection 3142. Notice of motion to release defendants on own recognizance. Comes now the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. Sure, by the way, this is only six pages long, so it'll be probably the last one. I might read the letter. Let's see how long this takes. But this is six pages long, but the actual document is about 250 pages. We've got all kinds of information, plus a DVD data disk attached to it with video, audio, and different things, pictures, lots of pictures. Okay, making the point here. Okay, comes now Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, Sureties of the Peace, proceeding as next friend, here and after Sureties of the Peace under Rule 1728 USCA, to move the court to release defendants on their own recognizance under 18 U.S.C. 3142 with the promise to appear. And by the way, this rule, 18 U.S.C. 3142, is the very same rule that they're using in order to incarcerate them. It's the very same rule that can be used to free them. And we have to read what is in general, okay? So under 18 U.S.C. 3142, the defendants are to have the presumption of innocence, first and foremost, okay, and be released pending trial on personal recognizance unless there is proof to determine that such release will not reasonably assure the appearance of persons as required or will endanger the safety of any person in the community or the community. And just the fact that, oh, no, they took over the refuge. Oh, they're evil. They had guns, and they're terrorists, and so on and so forth. Well, let's get some proof on that. You ain't got no proof. It doesn't mean nothing. It's just words hanging in the wind. It's irrelevant. You can't use it. The judge can't hang his hat on it. He must release. And the code says so. He must release. He doesn't have a choice in the matter. Unless they have proof of something. You know, they have drug problems, and they're violent people, and they have records, and they've been arrested numerous times before. They're known, they've got a bad reputation in the community. All is the opposite. They have no records. They don't do drugs. They have no alcoholic problems. They're pillars of the community within their families. They run ranches. They work. They're known in their own community. They're not terrorists. They're Americans. Matter of fact, in this case, they're the American cowboy. Let me go back. Unless there is proof to determine that such release will not reasonably assure the appearance of the person, just because the crime may be whatever they want to make it up to be, doesn't mean, oh, they're not going to come because we got this. No, that's not a reason. You have to prove they're going to run. You got to show that they've done it before. Otherwise, they have the presumption of innocence. You must release. Assurance of the appearance of the person is required will endanger the safety of any other person or the community. They must prove that they're dangerous. They must show something. Carrying a weapon is a Second Amendment right. That proves nothing. And none of these people were carrying any assault weapons. None of these people were carrying even semi-automatic weapons. Only a couple of them had some holstered guns. And not often. 18 U.S.C. 3142A, in general, first part of it. This is in general. This is the first part of the thing. After this, there's B, C, D, E, F, G. I think all the way down to I or something. And it gives the detail, if this is the case, or if that is the case, or if you got proof of this, or if they've run before, or if they've done this, or if they've done that, if they're a danger, if they're, you know, whatever the case is, none of those things exist. So the general is what is in view here, which is A, okay? A, 3142A, in general. Upon the appearance before a judicial officer of a person charged with an offense, the judicial officer shall issue an order that pending trial, the person be released on personal recognizance. You know, if you had a murder case here and you have the smoking gun and it's obvious in all likelihood this guy is guilty of sin, obviously you're not going to let the individual go. You don't have a smoking gun here and you don't have a murder. They couldn't even find anything to charge them with. The charges are so weak, it's pathetic. You know, we're pretty sad people that we're unable to see this clearly. Just go read the charges, how pathetic they are. And why did they wait 20 days or whatever it was to put the charges on? At best, the most they could have gotten was for trespassing. That's the maximum. And what's that? We'll give them a ticket and show up in court. That's what that is. Because of the presumption of innocence under our common law, the defendants need not prove that they are a danger or a flight risk. But just state that they aren't. The burden of proof is upon the prosecutor, and no facts exist. How are the defendants a danger? What specifically have the defendants done that would lead the court to believe that defendants are not honorable and will not appear? Simply being charged with a crime proves nothing. The prosecutor must produce documentary evidence. Where is the evidence? They have nothing, absolutely nothing. The sureties of the peace have heard compelling evidence continues to collect compelling evidence and thereby are preparing briefs and memorandums of law in support of the defendants because defendants' lawyers, by incompetency or conspiracy, after 6 months have failed to do so, and the sureties of the peace have a duty to speak. Statements of fact in support of release. The defendants are people of the United States and do not pose any danger to any other person or the community. The nature and circumstances of defense charges were not of crime of violence, terrorism, nor did it involve minor victims, controlled substances, illegal firearms, explosive, or destructive devices. Defendants are long time domiciled in their communities with family ties and deep roots and much community support. The defendants have no past adverse conduct history relating to drugs, alcohol, abuse, or criminal history and are, in fact, docile. The few defendants that occasionally carried sidearms did so lawfully and responsibly and never drew their lawful weapons and or pointed their lawful weapons on anyone. This is unlike federal agents and other alleged law enforcement agents who brought military-grade automatic weapons. Even when ambushed, had fired upon with perhaps 100 or more bullets, the defendants in that deadly event did not respond with their lawful firearms, and at that point they did have an unalienable right to defend themselves. Furthermore, firearms were lawfully permitted or Malheur Wildlife Refuge. See the brochure is attached. Weapons are permitted on that property. It was the defendants that were terrorized by rogue federal agents operating under the color of law. It was the rogue federal agents who have seized control of a federal agency, the BLM, patrolling state properties in armored vehicles dressed in full tactical gear, displaying deadly force, pointing fully automatic weapons on we the people within their sovereign state for no lawful reason. This prevented the defendants from exercising their unalienable rights upon their lawful properties and their lands within their sovereign states. It was the rogue federal agents who charaded as the defendants who terrorized the local people and law enforcement. See affidavit of Harding County Fire Chief Chris Briles. Rundon versus State. When a person being without fault is in a place where he has a right to be, is violently assaulted, he may, without retreating, repel by force, and if in the reasonable exercise of his right of self-defense, his assailant is killed, he is justified. The defendants had the unalienable right to meet force with force, but instead exercised restraint, which proves honor, not willing to put others in danger. They first pursued the judiciary branch of government to no avail, and then pursued the legislative branch of government to no avail. See congressional oversight hearing on public lands attached. Defendants did not understand the princedoms they called upon to seek justice, and believing that they had exhausted all lawful remedies, exercised the unalienable right to resist through peaceful civil disobedience and defiance in the face of tyranny. They hoped to accomplish critical mass, the necessary element for the people to take back their government from the tyrant BLM agents by the following prescription. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that amongst these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these end, it is the right of the people to alter government. When a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is the right, it is their duty to throw off such guards. Declaration of Independence. So it's the right of the people to get rid of these tyrants within our government. There is nothing wrong with our government. It's the people who have seized control of our government. That's the problem. The tyrants that have seized control of the strategic controls of our government. We need to throw off those gods and put on new gods. They need to be brought to justice, in courts of justice. Therefore, they decided to exercise that unalienable right of peaceful civil disobedience at the Wildlife Refuge, which was at the time dormant, with the expectation of a few maintenance custodians that periodically visited the site unimpeded during the peaceful civil disobedience. Knowing the violent tendencies of the tyrants in the BLM, the defendants believed that the refuge was far enough away so as to not put the townspeople life and limb in jeopardy. Therefore, the only impeding of agents was the impeding of their tyranny. The rattling of the saber. For about the first 3 weeks of January 2016, people from all over the country and the townspeople came and went peacefully with their children unimpeded up to the refuge and down into the towns. The defendants also went into the towns and back for meetings and supplies, all the while having peaceful relationship with the sheriff, the FBI, agents, members of the Committee of Safety, the townspeople, and others. We have pictures of shaking hands with the deputies. They're shaking hands with the sheriff, shaking hands with the FBI, and peaceful, you know, smiling and talking and going. Why didn't they arrest them? They had the opportunity many, 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 many times. Instead, they had to kill. About the fourth week, the federal administration, at the appeal of Governor Kate Brown, sent new leadership, thereby changing the peaceful demonstration through the rattling of a saber to disturbed and brutally violent end, thereby assassinating the defendant's constitutional mentor and almost killing the leadership of the peaceful demonstration and a female minor. This was totally uncalled for because any of these people could have been arrested peacefully at any time as they freely moved about. Just who are the terrorists here? The court needs to ask the question, just who are the terrorists here? And just who should be on trial? Lavoie Fittakin was a true American cowboy who owned a family-run ranch. He was a highly morally-minded man with no ties to drugs, alcohol, terrorism, or violent ties of any kind. Such was also the case with Ryan and Ammon Bundy and other defendants. On February 3, 2016, the prosecutor, under the color of law, fraudulently convened a statutory grand jury to indict the defendants under 18 U.S.C. subsection 372 without any documentary evidence from competent fact witnesses, any witness with firsthand knowledge, and further, without any injured party for political reasons and favors. The prosecutor, under the color of law, delivered the defendants into a nisi prius court under the rules of chancery and jurisdictions unknown, for political reasons, favors. The prosecutor, under the color of law and without authority, presumed the power of we the people by manufacturing plea agreements with defendants which are null and void through coercion for political reasons and favors. We, the sureties of the peace, have been monitoring the atrocities of the BLM upon the Bundys, the Hammonds, and others since about 2014, Bundy's Ranch standoff, and have accumulated an overwhelming amount of evidence to prove all the positions alleged in this motion to release. In an effort to not to overwhelm the court, we are providing only the following documents that will provide for the factual evidence to move this court to release all the defendants on their own recognizance under 18 U.S.C. subsection 3142. We have the affidavit, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 affidavits. We have a congressional oversight hearing of public lands, which is damning. Calls them, I forget the language, but it was pretty strong language what the Congress has called the BLM. Nothing short of tyrants, out of control, need to be stopped. All the stories and the atrocities that were written in it, it's good reading. Read the entire document. It's attached to this. It's right here on the page. It's attached right behind it. Read the documents. Read the affidavits. They're powerful. It sets the stage. Also, we've got a DVD that we set into this thing, and it has pictures and videos, and we do have those attached up here also. You can watch the videos, and you can download the pictures in a zip. All this proves that they were peaceful, that they were preparing. All the damages that was done up there was done by the feds, and we, the people, repaired those damages, and they cleaned up that mess and brought that wildlife preserve back into order. Wherefore, the court, being without any documentary evidence from a competent fact witness with firsthand knowledge and without any injured party, the sureties of the peace move this court to release the defendants without bail immediately. Dated August 22nd, sealed and signed by the grand jury foreman. Okay, those are the two papers we filed, and then there's the other one, which we'll read next week, and we'll talk about, and maybe people have some questions on. We'll try to answer those questions. But there is a letter. Let me see how long this letter is, see if I want to read this. It's not too long. It's three pages, and again, there's probably more footnotes than wordage on this, so let's go through it real quick. And this is to the clerk of the court, Mary L. Moran. On April 20th, 2016, the grand jury filed a habeas corpus under the case number, under above case number. Our records show that you received this document on April 26, 2016, certified mail number, and gives the number, and said habeas corpus did not show up on the docket. See attached docket, dated April 25th through May 11th. On April 27, 2016, the grand jury filed a default judgment under the above case number. Our records show that you received this document on May 2, 2016, certified mail number, and said and the said default judgment, again, did not show up on the docket. See attached docket. On April 6, 2016, the grand jury filed contempt of court under the above case number. Our records show that you received this document on May 9, 2016, certified mail number, so on and so forth, and said contempt of court, again, did not show up on the docket. See attached docket. Being a clerk, you must file it, or it is a crime punishable by a fine and 1 year in prison. 18 U.S.C., subsection 2076, clerk is to file whoever, being a clerk of a district court of the United States, willfully refuses, neglects to make or forward any report, any certificate, any statement, any document, as required by law, shall be fined under this title in prison not more than 1 year or both. Please be advised that being the clerk of the court, you have taken or should have taken an oath and thereby have a duty to speak to us. Silence can only be equated with fraud where there is a legal duty and moral duty to speak, or where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading, U.S. versus Tweel. Therefore, we will accept answers by counsels as non-answers. And or if you do not answer within 48 hours by both fax and mail, after receiving this inquiry, you will be charged with concealment by scheme under 18 U.S.C. 1001, obstruction under 18 U.S.C. 1512B, and refusal by clerk under 18 U.S.C. subsection 2076. If you have been coerced by someone else to conceal these three documents, you are required by duty and oath to report the crime immediately. If you refuse to answer within 3 days by fax and mail after receiving this inquiry, and we discover that you conspired with another, you will be charged with conspiracy against rights under 18 U.S.C. 241, concealment by scheme under 18 U.S.C. subsection 1001A, and obstruction under 18 U.S.C. 1512. If prisoner's life is lost because these papers were not filed, we will seek the maximum penalty under 18 U.S.C. subsection 241. If you were coerced by others and you respond with a sworn statement or affidavit by fax and mail, you will not be charged. If this was a clerical error, and look, at we gave them an out here. We gave them an olive branch right here. Listen to the final words on this paper. Okay? Here's the mercy. We have to always come with mercy. If it was a clerical error, maybe there was a clerical error here. Yeah, we'll accept that. Okay? If there was a clerical error, you are commanded to file the three documents attached. We send them another three copies with the seal. File it. And send proof, time-stamped, front pages, and copy of the docket by mail and fax immediately. All is forgiven. It was a mistake. Oh, okay. Let's just fix it. Get our documents in the court. Dated August 22nd, 2016, sealed with the grand jury signature and seal. Okay, those are the three documents. The fourth one we'll read next week, which, again, is a document that people can use in their court cases. But please understand the document. Understand what you're doing in a court. Don't think that that document's going to save anyone. You need to understand it. You need to understand jurisdiction. You need to know when jurisdiction has changed. You need to know when your rights are being violated. You need to know the processes and the procedures of the court. You need to know the rules of the court, and you need to operate under them. And if you're going to go in there, like some of these people, and fight a case or whatever case you may be fighting and think you're going to be talking about the man on the land, like, it means nothing. It means absolutely nothing. It's a case for them to get a psychiatrist, rule you unfit, muzzle you, and put a lawyer on you, and they'll do what they please with you. And the more you piss them off, the more hassle, the more they're going to put upon you. Don't fight court cases that way. It means nothing. It's a waste of time. And I think in the near future, we're going to talk more about that waste of time, and we're going to show you some examples of people who have wasted their time and ended up, or could have ended up, much more worse than they did for other reasons. Anyway, okay, that brings us to the end of that. I'm not going to, anybody has any questions or comments on this for me, after Brent finishes and we open up for general questions and comments, we'll take questions concerning these documents or any other questions people might have. Meanwhile, I guess we'll, but before we move to Brent, Gerard, do you have anything to add here, or any of the other national leadership have anything to add here tonight to what we're talking, or anything else that needs to be brought up?
No, I think you'd... It's an awful lot of stuff to go through, and I think it's very complete, and everybody should look it over because it's important stuff. And believe me, they're going to pay attention. Okay.
Anyone wants to get educated, this is how you get educated, reading cases. The best way to learn to write is read the people that wrote. Read cases, and go read Supreme Court rulings and decisions. Read the cases that we here at National Liberty Alliance, through the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, the people have written and put together and placed into the courts. We have lots and lots of documents. And you can pull things out of every one of these cases. You can pull little pieces. You can follow the things and the way we're doing things and you know, duplicate it. But again, you have to follow the processes and the procedures of the court. There's nothing wrong with them. Occasionally you get something that's wrong. It's repugnant. Let it be known. And demand it to be corrected if someone's trying to execute it upon you or something, you know. But look at a lot of these codes, man. Let me tell you, I use them all the time. It's their codes, and really, it's our codes. We elected individuals to the legislature to write codes for certain things, and these are the things: 18 U.S.C., 42 U.S.C., all of these things. Now, mind you, there's some bad stuff here or there, of course. Okay, that's repugnant. Get out your measuring tape. Your measuring tape is your unalienable rights. It's the Constitution. It's the Bill of Rights. It's your unalienable rights as you understand them, given by God. Lay that ruler out. And if it bears up, fine. If it doesn't measure up, it's out of here. Okay? And you declare it in the court. You lay it out. You make it clear. Okay. Anyway, Jen, are there any questions out there? Do we have any questions this week?
Yes, I have three questions this week. The first question, can you please define infamous crime for me? I'm unable to find a definition here. I understand it to be a crime that is punishable by one or more days in jail. Please confirm or deny.
Right. Yeah, I'll tell you what. I too have been looking, and maybe that's a question that might be best for Brent because he's done a lot of research. He may have come up with some things. But my understanding, ultimately, and the idea that I've seen out there that makes sense, is that anything that requires a jail sentence, which basically should be a violent crime, you know, I mean, jail sentences are not something that should be meted out for code violations, clearly. Jail sentences are not to be meted out because... necessarily because one person injured another person in some way or form, you know, they got to do restitution. The punishment is the restitution, and the restitution is part of the process of bringing that person back to repentance and also bringing them back into society and starting to learn to be humble and starting to do the right thing to people, you know. Treat people as you would have yourself to be treated. We have to go back into our schools and bring back morality. We need to bring back God into our schools. I know people cringe with that. Well, let me tell you, they created that cringement in you. The enemy done that. Don't run away from God. Run to him. They want you to run away from him. You will lose if you run away from him. Because this battle can only be won by God. Only. Period. You and me cannot win it. Only the people can save America, but only the people under the God, under his will, can save America. Only if we are within his will he bless whatever it is we're doing and make things happen to make things get better, okay? Only under those conditions. Without him, there is no hope at all, okay? But anyway, something that I think is violent would be an infamous thing. Also, you know, we'll look at, again, you know, if you injure somebody, okay, hey, you get the grand jury to come in there and agree. You get to come in, or the person can actually do a civil lawsuit, in a sense. It's the same court. There is no difference between the court, whether it's a criminal activity or something, you're suing somebody. It's the same court, okay? But, you know, you can bring charges, and if there's a contract concerned or something, or if there is an injury where you make a complaint and the person now has to answer, and if found that they're guilty of injuring you, then now they have to pay restitution. But that could call for a jail sentence also, okay, if it's violent, you know. I mean, that's a possibility. But, again, we try to get away from the jail part. We want restitution. We want to bring people back into society. We got a lot of thinking on those things and figuring on those things, and we need to dig into history more on those things and discover the best way to deal with these things. And then we can put these things into writing and suggestions so people who are the administrators training the people to come in to sit as grand jurist or to trial jurist to understand these different things, to give them a little bit of an education. And again, this needs to be done in school. Every child should be learning in school how to represent themselves. Every child should be learning in school what they need to be doing in society to give back, okay? Every child should consider it. Every person sometime in their life should be a committee man at least one term. It's a two-year term, no big deal, okay? But every person should become a committee man at least once. Every person should answer the call to a grand jury or trial jury call, every person. Nobody should reject it. And if nobody rejects it, you won't get called that often anyway, you know? So, but, you know, you got to go. And look, if you can't make it because you have a serious business deal coming up and you say, hey, put me on for the next call, and I can't do it this month, but next month I'm available. Get me in on that. You know, this is what we need to do. We the people have to step up and take control. We the people need to save America. And we need to do it with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. And that requires virtue, and that requires God. We have to do it under the veil of God, under His name. Okay, let me think here. Any other questions?
Yes, the second question is...
So I'm going to kind of push most of that answer over to Brent, if he can answer it. But go ahead, the second.
Okay. Do you want to do that before the second question, or?
No. When he picks up, he can start with that. Go ahead.
Okay. Other than Cruden versus Neo, is there anything written about statutes and codes not applying to the common man?
Well, statutes and codes that are constitutional apply to men somewhere. They're written for a certain purpose, but the criteria of those codes and writing of that legislation is found in the Constitution to begin with. We laid right out. U.S. 42, U.S. 18, a lot of stuff in there is very constitutional. It's we gave them authority to write this stuff. And it's a lot of good stuff. I use it all the time. But then there's stuff that's bad. So it's unconstitutional. So if you want to know the bottom line and where that Supreme Court ruling got their information from, go right to the source where they got their information from. It's called the Constitution, and you can read that under Article 1, particularly. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here, but you can read Article 1, Section 8, and many other places, but 8 is a good part, you know. Congress shall have the power to lay taxes, duties, imports, exercise to the debt, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and exercise shall be uniform throughout the United States. And it goes on to borrow money and to do different things, regulate Congress. And it gives all a list, establish post offices, constitute tribunals, different things to make laws. And then at the end it says to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all the powers vested in this Constitution in the government of the United States or in the department or officer thereof. So you see, we lay out very specifically what they can write codes on right here in the Constitution. And now anything outside, you know, you get into the Bill of Rights, and it makes the point that you know, anything else is reserved back to the states and the people respectfully. Now, when you get into the state, they're still governed by the same Ten Amendments. You know, the Bill of Rights. They are governed by that. That is the ruler. Anytime a state constitution writes anything in it that is repugnant to this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which includes the Bill of Rights, take out your constitutional ruler and lay it out, and if it measures up, fine. If it doesn't, it's repugnant, it's null and void. Make your case and get rid of it. Convince the jury. Have it dispersed, thrown away. Sometimes something might be good for one thing and not good for another thing. Every case is different, you know. The facts change, and the players change, and everything changes from one case to another. No two cases are the same. So anyway,
John, isn't there a lot of cases that claim that statutes are not positive law? I mean, look.
Well, I thought we had quite a few of them out there, but I don't remember them.
There's Supreme Court rulings that say that, and look, a statute is really it applies to who has the contract. In other words, you know, it more applies to our public officials than men.
Generally,
you
that's
know,
what
that's
statutes speaking, are written for.
That's right, because, you know, look, we don't want them running our cars that we pay for more than 55. That applies to them. That's not for us. Those are those people that work for us. And I know they think that's ridiculous that we should be able to determine how fast we drive, but, you know, liberty takes maturity and responsibility. But in a public official, we're going to tell them what to do because they're working for us using our resources. And so those statutes apply to them. See, they've turned everything on its head. They made them apply to us. And we think that the police are the only ones who can break the statutes because they run around at speed and do whatever they want to do, right? So everything's
exactly
upside down right now.
Yeah, you know, look, you got to use common sense, too. Obviously, you can't run 100 miles an hour down a one-way street where there's a school crossing and so on and so forth. You have to have, you know, realization, and you can't put children in jeopardy. You can't put people in jeopardy. You know, if there's a crosswalk there, you come to a stop, you let the people go, and you look around, you go. That makes common sense. And let me tell you, people who break that and just speed down there, eventually they're going to do something. They're going to get it, do a lot of damage or hurt somebody or kill somebody, and common law is going to come down them like a ton of bricks, and then other people will see, wow, you know, I better not do that. That's what it takes to fix the problem, then that's what it takes. But the key thing is this, learning what is right and wrong in schools, teaching the golden rule, bringing God back into the school, the Ten Commandments, teaching children true civics, teaching them the Constitution, the processes of the court and the law, about the committee men, well, how our political process works, along with their reading, writing, and mathematics and all the other necessary things. And they need to learn American history. They need to learn the things necessary in order to be a good human being. Train up a child on how they should walk, and they will not depart from it. That's a promise from God, by the way. So if you think, just think about that. If we as a people are good people with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy, make our schools to train up our children. We train them up at home the right way that they should walk. We require the schools to train them up the way they should walk. And God promises if you train up your child on how they should walk, when they are older, they will not depart from it. Okay? Take that to the bank. People can disbelieve that. That's fine. I bank on it. So, and I trust in that, and I believe it, and it works for me in my life anyway. And I know others it does too. Okay. Anything else?
Yes.
I'm sure there are
more.
A lot of other things. We may have something in our jury handbooks on other court cases. But if not, maybe others may know. They can bring it up. But go ahead.
Okay, the last question is, what are the police powers in D.C., and or can police powers in D.C. be different from the several states?
Well, look, at police powers. First of all, let's go into the states. The police powers of D.C. have no power authority in the states. They only have power or authority on the lands that they have to deal with. Okay, so yeah, they have to deal with the problems. They have to, for instance, there's a they have a navy, they have an army. They have to deal with any kind of criminality or broken laws there. They have to deal with the city, the federal city, which is Washington D.C. Okay, so yeah, they can make their own rules and do their own things for that purpose, but it shouldn't be anything outside of our Constitution. It's our Constitution. They're ruled under the same Constitution we are. I don't know. Maybe they should have a sheriff there. I don't, that's something I think we have to think about. I haven't looked too deeply into that, and I haven't given much thought, but I'm sure if we did look deeply into it, look at some history, give it some thought, and apply some logic, we'll come up with all kinds of ideas. And maybe someone has already done that, and we're just not aware of it. And if anybody is aware of that, maybe they can tell us about it, and we can start to become educated in that area. When I hear the word police powers, I get nervous, you know. I like constitutional officers that maintain law and order. And why shouldn't we have a constitutional officer in Washington, D.C. that maintains law and order? I mean, if we're under common law, they're under common law, and if they're under common law, they have to have a common law, law enforcement agent, such as the sheriff. That's how the whole process was put. So maybe Washington, D.C. needs a sheriff. I don't know. We'll see what others may think. Maybe Brent can think about that. Maybe he's got something on that, too. I don't know. Anything else?
Nope, that's it for now.
Okay, I'm going to move things over to Brent, and Brent, maybe if you want to respond to some of those things, if not, you can go right into your subject. Brent is with us tonight, and he is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you get the mic.
He must be muted.
Star 6, Brent. Star 6, unmute. Let me unmute him. What are Electra? Well, he should be in. Should be okay.
Right, now
try
I'm
it
unmuted.
Now, Brent. There you go.
Yeah,
okay.
You got me. No, I did it. It did not work from my end, so we'll remember that next time. Thanks for unmuting me, John. And thanks for having
okay.
me. Let me on again. Those are good questions. The reason I say they're good, a good question is a question I can say something about. That makes it more enjoyable. There's a lot of things I don't know. I don't know everything about these questions, but I can say something about them that may relieve tension or shed a little enlightenment on the subject. Let me start at the bottom. Last thing that was mentioned was police powers. And the question, as I got it, was, are police powers in the District of Columbia, can those be different there than they are in the states of the United States? Well, yes, they can, and sometimes they are. Oftentimes they are. Two examples that come to mind, one from the administration of Woodrow Wilson in his day, and then the other one I've mentioned before about the Second Amendment. But it was, for example, on all federal territory, such as, whether right or wrong, Indian reservations, the District of Columbia, military bases and arsenals and dockyards, naval dockyards, and federal courthouses, any federal property, any federal real estate is under the jurisdiction of Congress. Congress is the master of all federal property. They can do whatever they want with it, and they have the power to either provide police power regulations or not do it. Again, police powers are those powers that go to the health, education, and welfare of the people living in the area under consideration, the jurisdiction, the territorial jurisdiction, or the piece of real estate under consideration. Police powers. Every state of the United States has police powers within the raw territorial boundaries of each particular state. That has to do with statutes like you must ensure, for instance, that your children are educated. A lot of states, it doesn't say how that's to happen. It just says you're to ensure it. Some of them are more particular than others and say you've got to teach them about history and science, etc. Those are police powers because that goes to education. And also there are regulations and statutes and regulations that go to just plain health. You're not allowed, for example, to drive drunk. If you drive drunk, you put other people's lives in danger and your own. Well, in Washington, D.C., Congress has the power to make those regulations, and on military bases, of course. And in the states have power to do that. That's a police power. It goes to the health and safety and the welfare of people. But I started to talk about Woodrow Wilson. There was a time before Woodrow Wilson came on the scene. By the way, Woodrow Wilson was a staunch Presbyterian. His father, he was president of Princeton Seminary, a Presbyterian school at that time, still very fundamental. As a matter of fact, the word fundamentalism came from the faculty of Princeton Seminary. Well, he came out of that environment. He had been a professor and never done anything his whole life. He was kind of an egghead. Nice fella. Didn't know squat from straight up about politics. He'd written a book about Congress, but he'd never even been there, never been in the Chamber of Congress. And he was, he became a useful tool for evil men, and he admitted that in his life. But during his administration, polygamy was okay on federal Indian reservations. Polygamy. Well, Woodrow Wilson was appalled when he found that out. And so he put out an executive order, said, of course, the Indian agents said that the Great White Father in Washington, D.C. says you've got to pick the wife you like the best and get rid of the rest. And one of the Indian agents squatted down under a juniper tree with an old chief out in Arizona, and he said, the Great White Father has decided you can't have 10 wives anymore, chief. And the chief was puffing on his pipe, contemplating the situation, and he said, well, what should I do? He said, well, you've got 10, you need to choose 9 of them, and the 9 you want to leave, pick the one you like the best and tell the others to leave. Well, he thought about that a while, and he decided that that wasn't a good idea, and he told the Indian agent, he said, you tell him to leave. I'll pick the one I want, and you tell him to leave, because he was afraid of what would happen if he told his wives to leave. Well, I tell you all that story just hoping you'll remember this principle about police powers. The federal government had the right to say yes or no to polygamy. Now, there's some question whether or not, I don't know in that case whether Woodrow Wilson actually just did that by himself by executive order. I suspect he probably did. I imagine Congress didn't get involved at all. But nonetheless, the states have no police power on federal Indian reservations or federal courthouses or dockyards or military bases or other federally owned property. And in the states, they do. Well, that's the kind of the story about the police powers. There are other things that happen. We had talked, for example, in the District of Columbia, Congress said that nobody could have a handgun, couldn't even have one in their own house, up until 2008. And the Heller decision, District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court of the United States reversed that and said, no, they can. But you see, up till that point, D.C., the standard in D.C. was different than most of the rest of the states. Most of the rest of the states, you had the right to have a firearm, whereas Congress said in D.C. you can't. Well, that's been changed now, of course, by that. But the point I'm making is, in response to the question, yes, the police power standards can be different on federal property, like the District of Columbia, and within the boundaries of the states. And I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. I'll say it again. Some of you folks out there read some big, thick books. I know I've talked to some of you. Well, there's a good one. It is the exhaustive statement upon the question of police powers within the several states and the balance of power between the federal government and the state government. This is the definitive work. I think it was published in the year 1868, written by a fellow named Tom Cooley. Tom Cooley, C-O-O-L-E-Y. And Tom Cooley, there's a law school named after him up in the northern Midwestern states. I believe it's in Michigan. Tom Cooley School of Law. Cooley School of Law. But it's good reading, by the way. He's a good writer. You can pick parts out of it, enjoy reading it. But he explains the balance between the federal and state governments. Well, then the other question was, had to do, let me hit this one. It was the first question. Infamous crimes. What is an infamous crime? Well, as most things in our common law tradition, definitions are, well, they're confusing to people because we use words and phrases in our common law tradition in so many different ways. As a matter of fact, the rest of the world makes fun of us and says we have no precision. They say we're messy. Our thinking isn't in order. Well, all that's true, very true. Our common law is messy. I listen to people talk about the common law and ask questions about what this means and what that means, and of course they repair to the dictionaries, like Bouvier and Black's, and those are good and helpful sometimes, but the truth is, it's not possible, really, to define common law terms very well, because it is the nature of our common law that it's not well defined until, now watch this, don't miss this, until it comes up against its great antagonist, until there is a fight. Our common law itself is not even definable unless seen in contrast to its great antagonist, the law of the city. The law of the land versus the law of the city. I'm not the first one to say that. Every comparative lawyer I've ever read, going back as far as the 14th century, the 13th century, the 12th century, is coming right on up through Professor Merriman, Bolt Hall in Berkeley, and Fratcher of the University of Missouri, and Rounds of Suffolk University School of Law, Massachusetts. All these fellows say the same thing. We can't define it in any way that's simple. They'll usually write down, they'll say, I've read some of their articles, Encyclopedia of Law. I know Rounds recently, I read one of his. He uses about four definitions, and they're not that related. And he said sometimes it's used this way and sometimes it's used that way. That is why it's important when it comes to our common law that we don't try to treat it as though it's a mathematic equation and as though all of its words are mathematically definable precisely. No, they aren't. That we are not a part of the law of the city. You know, the whole world, again, covered like a blanket, every country in the world is under some form of the Code of Justinian, the Roman Code, the Law of Babylon in its various forms, except those few countries that are under Islamic law, and those are substantially the same. Matter of fact, they have the same roots. The same thing is true of Talmudic law, have the same roots as Islamic law and as Roman law. They're all Babylonish in the final degree. And all of these forms of law, all of these countries, by the way, are bent on utter precision. And even our measurement system here in our common law country, the United States, our English measurement system, the people in the rest of the world make fun of it because their precision, their measuring systems are more precise, much more precise. We in here in America, we measure horses not by inches or millimeters or meters. We measure them by hand. We measure tobacco by hands. We measure grain by the bushel. And all of those things, initially, when they first started especially, and land, we measure them by the hide. We now have narrowed it down to more precision with the acre. But the foot was at one time a man's foot. I was at Walmart not long ago, and I watched a woman at the material counter measure material using the old common law method before people had yardsticks of, from the tip of her nose out to the end of her hand and drew the bolt of cloth out that way and then laid it down and cut it off. It's amazing, though, our common law is attuned to our body's fathoms, and 4 inches is the width of a hand, of course, and 6 inches is your thumb extended to the tip of your little finger. And just like in the old world, they use the cubit. We see that in the Bible. It's about 18 inches, just a hair over, a give or take. But we're always a give or take people because we believe, as common law, as common people in a country of common law tradition, that justice must be substantial. And we as human beings, we're not God, we're men. We're not God, we're men. We're not God, I should say. We are men. And we shoot for substantial justice, not precise justice. I've been on cases before where, and it scares me to death when an engineer gets on the jury. He'll try to put everything on paper and figure it out according to a mathematical equation, how much a man is owed in damages. Well, if he's going to do that, he needs to go to law school and learn all those things. But to try to do that on as a juryman, is not what we want. If we wanted that kind of thing, we'd get engineers on jury, and that's all we let on a jury is engineers. But we don't want that. We want men that can feel what a lawyer, a judge, and a police officer can't feel. We want men who can reach inside their guts and say, something stinks here. This ain't right. That's what we want. That's why we have juries. Why? Because, as Chesterton says, they're not used to it. The judges, the lawyers, and the police officers are just too used to it, and they want to be precise and parse everything out exactly. Well, that's not what our common law tradition is. We're talking about infamous crimes. I got off. It's hard to define infamous crime. An infamous crime, though, is whatever the court says it is. We say the Supreme Court says it's this or that. Well, the Supreme Court, half the time anymore, we see they don't know what they're talking about. There's been plenty of times through the history of our country they've made a lot of mistakes. What is infamy? Infamy is something that's well known. It's famous. Infamous. You attach a preposition to a word, whether no matter what language it's in, and it intensifies the word in some way. Infamous means well known. If you are convicted of an infamous crime, you're convicted of a crime of which there is no question you've committed the crime. Murder has always been and will always be an infamous crime. That's infamous. As is arson, as is rape. Those are infamous crimes. Now, what about a tax return? The government prosecutes a fellow for not filing a tax return. Is that an infamous crime? Well, the government and the IRS would say it is. You see, it's a matter of degree. But I know plenty of people that wear that as a badge of honor and say, I stood up to those guys. And I know plenty of other people that hold people who have stood up to them in high esteem. So it depends upon the person, what infamous is. You see, it's not infamous to not file a tax return, really. That's not something that has always been a crime among mankind. I have an idea in my head of what infamous is. It's well known. Treason is infamous. Murder is infamous. Rape is infamous. But just because Congress or a state legislature says something is a crime doesn't make it a crime. And now we are inundated with things that folks know better than to say they're crimes. They're just crimes because some misguided legislature said so. And the fellow recently has written a book called Three Felonies a Day, and he argues in the book that almost every American commits at least three felonies a day and doesn't even know it because there are so many crimes statutorily on the books that we can't keep up with them. And that, by the way, is true. Well, that's what infamous is. It means famous, well-known, without question, unambiguously, a crime, murder, treason, rape, such things. They're statutory, by the way, in most of those cases. They're not common law crimes. They tell me, one other point on this head, they tell me that in England, I've always heard this, there is no statute of Parliament against murder. Never has been. If people commit murder, they prosecute them because the courts have always held, the juries have always held, that murder is a crime because the Bible says it's a crime. God says it's a crime. Our senses, even without the Bible, tell us there's something wrong with killing an innocent man without justifiable cause. That's an infamous crime. There is no statutory law. That brings us to positive law, and that was one of the questions of the three. Positive law. What is positive law? Simply put, and this has been the understanding for centuries, and, well, I'll mention some about that more, maybe try to flesh it out a little bit. Positive law is human law. Positive law is human law. Human drafted law, such as, for example, legislation. To put it in context, a slave from the state of Virginia. No, not the state of Virginia. It was right during the time of the American Revolution. It would have been quasi-colony, quasi-state. But this slave, a black man, was taken to England by his master. And when he got there, he was a smart fella. He fled. He fled, and he fled because he believed, and he believed he knew for sure, and by the way, he was right, that once your foot touches the soil of that island called Britannica, Britain, every man, regardless of his former condition of servitude, is ipso facto and forever free. That's always been the law, and it's always, always, always been the law. It was called the Free Soil Doctrine, and we imported it here to the United States. It became very important in the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the year 1858, and Kansas declared itself to be free soil. The Supreme Court of Illinois declared it to be free soil. It had a similar case where a man crossed over from Kentucky to farm his land. He brought his slaves, and they fled for the same reason. That was later. But the Somerset case in England came before none other than a fellow by the name of Murray, a Scotsman, who was called Lord Mansfield, Justice Mansfield. And he said this. He said, I have searched in that case. He said, I have searched the laws of England as far back as I can to time out of memory. That means going back clear to before the time of Magna Carta. And he said, I cannot find anything in the laws of England that justifies slavery on the island of England. Even though some people had brought slaves there and it had been practiced, their law had always been against it because of the common law. The common law never allowed slavery. And that is why we had slavery in America, because England said America was not under the common law, but under the imperial law of the emperor, who was king of England, but emperor here. And that's why it caused such confusion here, by the way. It's caused confusion ever since. But the Somerset case, Mansfield said that if slavery were to exist in England, I'm getting to the positive law here, if slavery were to exist in England, it would have to exist by positive law. What did he mean? He meant by an act of parliament, legislation. Positive law is, to boil it down to its simplest understanding, positive law is legislation of a legislature, a decree of an emperor, an executive order of a president. It is positive law. It is set in place by man. It's not something, whereas non-positive law is law that is knowable through the laws of nature, unwritten in creation. And the laws of nature is God written in our Bibles, to use Blackstone's words. That's positive law. To give you a book to read, since I know this is a reading crowd, this book was written by Herman Melville, the author of Moby Dick. And the book wasn't discovered until the 1920s among his papers. He had written the book. It isn't a long book. It's a short book. He had written it and never published it. It is published now. I've read it 2 or 3 times, maybe more. I commend it to you. It's an easy, quick read. The name of the book is Billy Budd. Billy Budd, B-U-D-D, Billy Budd, Sailor. And it's about a young sailor by the name of Billy Budd, who was impressed into service on an English warship from a merchant ship. And he was well-liked. He was perfect in every way except one, it seemed. He had a terrible problem with stuttering. And he ended up killing a man without trying to, who falsely accused him of mutiny, conspiracy to mutiny. And he was hung at sea for it. And he was hung because the positive law, the code of the sea, it's a military law. It is the code of Rome, or the law of Rome, a military law, demanded it, even though it wasn't his intention to kill the other fella. And that's what the story is all about. And the reason that story has great significance is because Herman Melville, the author of Moby Dick, one time a sailor himself on a whaler, that's why I like to write about the sea, but he, his father, was Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. And his father-in-law, and his father-in-law was a positivist. A positivist. That means he believed in the power of positive law, and he believed that all positive law should dictate, and court opinions and interpretations of it shouldn't matter. Let me repeat that. Positive law and a positivist. The positivist movement was big in America, and there are still positivists around. is a person who believes that statutes should govern everything, and we should scuttle our common law and our court interpretations of the law. That position, friends, neighbors, and relatives, of a positivist is Babylonian to the core. It is Roman to the core. It is Persian to the core. It is the evil empire to the core. It is the code of Justinian, the code of Rome, the law of the Roman Empire. And what all the, for example, Justinian, he was a Roman emperor, and when he finally put the Roman law in its final legislative form as a product of the emperor, not a legislature, he was the legislator, the dictator, he put it in place. And as all men who believe this, and most all the world, by the way, believe this, he didn't want any court to have to do anything, to make any decisions. He wanted it so abundantly clear what his will was that that ended the matter. All you had to do was go to the court, apply the code. You never weren't even allowed, as all the civil law world today, weren't even allowed to look at former court opinions for guidance. That's evil, friends. And there is a movement among patriots in our own country, and has been for a long time, saying we got to get rid of the common law. And they've got all the arguments. And they sound good on the surface, but they bring tyranny. You see, because a common law government's a government of separation of powers. And if you get rid of an independent judiciary, no matter how crazy they act, and believe me, I know how crazy courts can be. I've been abused by them in more ways than you could imagine, as a lawyer and as a defendant. But I still say that independence of our courts is probably, arguably, the most fundamental common law distinctive we have that ensures our freedoms. The courts have the right, no, not the other right, used in the right way, they have the responsibility to look at legislation and pass opinion on it, whether or not it's lawful. Every person in government has that responsibility. Every president, every judge, every juror. Again, the beauty of our common law tradition, it divides power, and everybody is responsible to do the right thing at every moment. And that's what has made us powerful. But a positivist, for example, Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia was a hero of the conservative movement. But Justice Scalia, I had mentioned this last week or week before, and I've gone and listened to him speak. I've been in sessions where he was asked questions. I never asked him one, but I've been where others have asked him. Nice fella, sincere fella. I'm glad he was on the Supreme Court. It worked out well. But he was a positivist because he was a Romanist to the core. And even when he approached the Constitution of the United States, if it didn't say it just that way, he wasn't willing to mess with it. And if it wasn't in the Constitution, he says it's not a right. Our Constitution, by the way, says otherwise. It says there are certain rights that are not enumerated, fundamental. And a fundamental right is what it is, regardless of whether our Constitution, by the way, a document penned of the observations of men, and a good one. But just because our Constitution doesn't mention a right that may be fundamental, that means directly bestowed upon a man or woman from God. Just because our Constitution doesn't delineate that, that doesn't mean that it's not there. Now, on the other hand, when our Constitution is applied to government, yes, it's limited to what it says. That's true. It only has, the federal government only has certain powers, period. But that's not true applied everywhere else. It is a man or a woman's religious convictions that drive their understanding of law. No exceptions. No exceptions. And again, I'm in good company when I say that, and men have been observing it, and courts have been observing it for centuries, even till the very recent and our very recent times. So positivism, again, and the nice thing about Billy Budd, it's not a legal treatise, but he tells a short story, which is a short novel is really what it is, that's what a short story is, to strike back at his father-in-law, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts, and he uses this driving, riveting story. It's riveting. You got to read it. Called Billy Budd, about Billy Budd, the sailor, the young sailor that was hung. Well, that's pretty much covers, I've talked a while. Let me just say a little bit about the militia, because I want to do that every time I'm on if I can. I don't want to just leave that alone. We've been talking about the militia that several states. I'll limit it to a shorter time because I've spoke quite a while. The militia of the several states we've been talking about week by week. The militia of the several states, our Constitution cites it, of course, for clauses. We've been talking about those four militia clauses, and I remind you again, those four clauses are the supreme law of our land. The supreme law of our land, that means they are the way things are to be done. They are the process that is to be followed. That's what the law of the land means. But also our Declaration of 76 alludes to it in a powerful way, the militia, because the militia has always been around. It's part of that eternal law of men that God has given to us to use for our own good. The militia is always here. Whether or not the militia uses itself or participates in freedom is another question, but you can't get rid of the militia. The militia is the people. The militia of the several states lies at the foundation of our common law freedoms and forms the strong cords woven into the fabric of our Constitution meant to limit government. Without it, our Constitution weakens. Without the militia, that is, our Constitution weakens. Simply put, says Justice Joseph Story of our United States Supreme Court, he says this, the salient purpose of the militia of the several states is to be the ever-present, ever-feared, and thus ever-effective check and limit to any government, officeholder, agent, clerk, or employee who would use his position, power, or office to trespass upon any person's God-given rights. Now, that was not a quote, but that is what Justice Story said. I just kind of summed it up. He had a lot to say about it. Our U.S. Declaration of 76, and I like to call it the Declaration of 76 because the word independence doesn't appear anywhere in the document. That title, Declaration of Independence, was given to it later, popularly. It is not a Declaration of Independence. It is a Declaration of Shifting Dependence. Shifting Dependence. From the Crown of England, shifting dependence from the Crown of England and Parliament for protection to the judge of all the world, God himself. And those that drafted the Declaration of 76 made that abundantly clear, capping the end of it and the end of it like bookends on both ends with statements making that clear that their dependence is upon God. Well, paragraph 8 of our Declaration of 76 says this, King George has refused for a long time, after such dissolutions of local legislative bodies, to cause others to be elected. He was stopping them from electing legislative bodies to set laws in place, whereby the legislative powers, they say, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining, in the meantime, exposed to the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. Now, among the foremost legislative powers of common law government are taxation and common defense and coining money. Taxation, common defense, and coining money. That, by the way, is the chief reason for the Congress of the United States. All the other things that Congress does, I'd say most of them at this point, are unlawful outside of the limits of our Constitution. But Congress' chief reason for being there is for fairness of taxation. You know, Congress has two incredible powers. Congress has the power to take your private property from you by taxation. You only have three things in this life. You have life, you have liberty, and you have property. That's it. You don't get anything else. And to take any one of those is to take down the other two. The three of those, by the way, rise and fall together. Ask anybody that's been in prison. They had their liberty taken. That's what prison is. It takes your liberty. Ask them if they have a life. And ask them if they have property. They don't have property. And if you don't have property, you don't have life. They're inextricably bound together. Life, liberty, and property. Congress has the power to take your property from you. Then it also, second, it has this other incredible power. It has the power to declare war and take boys. And now, amazingly, and against the law of God, they're talking about taking girls and putting them between the violence and viciousness of an evil enemy in our own land, our own country. Those are the powers of Congress, and of course, coining money is the other one. That's an incredible power. And it, by the way, through that, Congress has the opportunity to abuse through all those, and of course, that happens more often than we want to really talk about, but it sure does happen a lot. Wars, even without declaration of war. But here our Declaration of 76 in this paragraph 8 charges the King of England, he said he was emperor in the colonies, of course, it charges him with destroying the legislative power. But it says here that it is impossible to destroy the legislative power because the Creator has given it to people and it is inextricably bound up with them and each person. And it says that the legislative power then returns to the people by nature. And it does. There's that phrase again, the people, referring, by the way, to the militia, to people. But with keeping those powers at the militia level, the people, by force, keeping the militia from mustering, that's what George and Parliament were doing. They were trying to keep the militia from mustering for the common defense, according to their legislatures of each colony, the legislature's regulation. England didn't want that. Parliament didn't want that. And rulers that bar people from choosing officers and mustering together as the armed militia to protect their families, neighbors, property, and country force the people to trust rulers for the defense of themselves. And therein lies the great danger. Let me repeat that. Rulers that bar the people from choosing officers and mustering together as the armed militia to protect their families, neighbors, property, and country, force the people to trust rulers for the defense. Let me give you a maxim of the common law I think that's applicable here. Whoever you trust for your protection is your master. Whoever you trust for your protection is your master. And if you're dumb enough, naive enough, to trust police officers, to trust a standing army, I don't want to say you deserve what you get, but some people would say that. I don't say that. I don't like that idea. It's always wrong for people to abuse other people, even if they trust in them. If people do relegate trust to the government, and the government then comes and abuses them, those people have been wronged. They don't deserve what they get. No, they don't. Because no man, I don't care what the circumstances are, deserves what they get. I've seen plenty of women who have entrusted themselves to the wrong people and have been abused. That doesn't mean they deserve what they get. It means they've been abused. And we, as Americans, have a duty not to entrust our protection to others. That's what Sam Adams said. He said there's nothing, and Noah Webster said the same thing, there's nothing that will be withheld from us that if we are wise enough to entrust our protection only to ourselves. The preamble of our Constitution says this, and I'll end with this. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The phrase "the people" appearing here is often mistaken to be a synonym for democracy. It is not. Never has been. It is not a synonym for democracy. It signifies rather those bearing the common law duties of the militia and of grand juror, petit juror, that's what the militia duty is, the militiamen's, and if able-bodied to carry arms to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Those are the three reasons for the militia of the several states when called into national service. The phrase "the people" became common through English translations of the Bible's Hebrew phrase "ha'am," signifying those of Israel having militia-like duties, the militia of the 12 tribes, the 12 separate tribes of Israel. Thus, the phrase "the people" embraces anyone willing to fill any of the three fundamental militia duties, serving as a grand juror, petit juryman, or as an armed militiaman. Well, our Constitution, I'll talk about a few other places in our Constitution besides the four militia clauses that allude to the militia of the several states. One other thing I want to note here, it is important to always keep this in mind. People often, patriot people, say, "I want the Constitution to be followed." The Constitution. And I believe it's important that a person ask themselves, why? Why the Constitution? And if folk don't have a good answer for that, then what they're believing is based upon nothing. We must know why the Constitution is the law of the land. That means due process. That's what our common law is, the way things are to be done. It is because our Constitution has proven itself, and was at the time it was penned, a regurgitation in compact brief. I'm quoting the Supreme Court. I like that phrase. In compact brief of common law government. That's what our Constitution is. Our common law is the laws of nature in the nature of things as God sets them forth before our eyes, unwritten in creation. We've observed them for centuries, and those who drafted our Constitution were putting to paper the simplicity in brief. They don't explain anything. They don't expound anything. They don't tell us what a jury is, how it's to be chosen, what a dollar is, what a militia is. No, that's not the purpose. It is informed, as our Supreme Court has said, by our common law. And to not know something of our common law to inform the clauses of our Constitution is to be wholly ignorant of our Constitution. I'd like to use the example of Mexico. Mexico took our Constitution and made it their own. It's not word for word, but in a lot of places it almost is. They called it the Mexican Constitution of 1824. And it remained their Constitution for a long time. They never did use it because they didn't understand it. Because in their heart of hearts, down deep inside, they believed in their religious minds, as they still do in Mexico, and a dictator to tell them what to do, called the Pope of Rome at that time. And they transferred that to their government. And though they had it on paper, it didn't mean anything to them. The common law wasn't part of their understanding. It wasn't part of their culture. It still isn't. And we've been blessed with this for generations. And if we're stupid enough, that means, I use the word in the technical sense, thick and slow, stupid enough to let it go, to not try to learn something about the common law that stands by every phrase and word, stands by it and behind every phrase and word of our Constitution, our freedoms will slip away. Thanks, John. That's enough for this evening. I can tell when it's enough sometimes. My voice starts getting a little bit weak, but I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. All right. If anybody's got any questions for Brent, we'll take a few questions. Let's move over to Q. Anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 to get into the queue, and I think it's just one after that, but star 6. And so if anybody has any questions for Brent, pop in there. Okay, our first caller is someone from Georgia. What's that? Marva? Go right ahead.
Hi, this is Marva. I have a question. Thank you for the letters that you were referencing before. I have a fraudulent ticket that was given to me in Rockingham, North Carolina, which is Richmond County. And it happened the day it snowed. And it was actually, I think some guys were just trying to make money, and they directly called initially a friend of theirs that has a towing service, and the deputies, two deputies came. And then once they were there, after a while, they called, one of them called on their cell phone a trooper, and that trooper came out. He gave me, all I needed done basically was to call AAA to have them pull me out, which is exactly what they did. But the trooper gave me a ticket. He gave me a ticket for exceeding safe speed for conditions and also driving with license suspended, however, or revoked. However, he validated that I have a valid driver's license in Georgia. He told me what my license number was and all of that. Well, since that time, and so this springs also, by the way, from a false charge in 2009, which I had taken up to the Supreme Court thus far, which really needs to be redressed, of a DUI and resisting officer. I actually do not drink, and I don't use any substance at all. So there have been several misstatements of the law, et cetera. On this particular ticket, though, just to stick with it, I actually was trying to identify if there is anybody in North Carolina who can assist me, what you would suggest, if there's anybody who can go to court. The last time I went, the judge actually happened to be a friend of mine. We went to college together, so she recused herself, and it was rescheduled to September 21st. The time prior to that, however, I went to court. However, I got there after the roll call. And so I was actually put in jail. Although I did specially appear. I was physically there in the court. They alleged that the judge arrested me, that there was an order for my arrest. It was pretty hostile, to be honest with you.
Let me just respond, you know, because we a lot of people have these kind of problems, and some more of a problem than others, of course, and each court acts differently, it seems, and so on and so forth. You know, we're battling against this. The best we can do is try to keep ourselves as much out of trouble as possible. We have to figure out where we got to pick our fights, where we want to fight. You know, I choose to fight up on this on the federal district courts and dealing with the big things. And as far as driving and those kind of things, I just try to watch myself, and I'll pay the fine. I'm not going to get into a big deal. I mean, I'll try to write a paper in, and that gets me somewhere fine. Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. And maybe at a later date, I'll go back and do some suing when we're on the other side of things, when we can get a common law courts back in process. So there's a lot of abuse going on down there. But if you need assistance with people coming to the court, when you go into court, you know, you should be able to get whatever friends and people you know, of course, to go. But you can also call into our Court Watchers group, and people in the area will come down and sit in the courtroom if we got somebody down there, and I'm sure we probably do. You're in Long Island, right?
No, this is in North Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, what county did you say you were in?
It's in Richmond County. This particular
okay. Yeah, cases. I was thinking New York City when you said Richmond. Okay. All right. So, but anyway, I'm sure we have people down there, and if we do, we can get a couple people maybe come down, you know, take some notes, write an affidavit for you, and give it to you, and then you can use it however you want. But again, I would suggest trying to get out as quick as possible with the path of least resistance, and sometimes paying that fine is the way to go. Again, you know, you have to pick your battle where you want to make it. And you got to understand at some point when – you know, if you're picking your battle here, and then these guys really get out of hand and they start looking at contempt of court, you can really get yourself into some trouble. Even though they truly don't have this power and authority, none of these courts have the power and authority to fine or incarcerate, yet they do anyway. There's nothing we could do about it at the moment. It's an uphill battle. It's hard. Traffic court is a good way to learn a little bit about court, be careful in any of these courts, because these people, there's nothing worse or more dangerous than ignorance in action.
Well, I guess the question is, I mean, obviously I filed a motion to dismiss. There's no injured party, no corpus delicti, or anything like that. So I filed a motion to dismiss in that regard. And I'm just wondering, are there other things I can do? To be frankly honest, I've experienced things that I never thought I would experience in my life. I've been blessed.
On these levels, it's not worth the battle. I mean, you could try. As soon as you start to see that these people are ignorant and they can be vindictive and vicious, when you start to realize that, your best bet is just get out of there. I'd rather give them $100 or whatever it is they want and walk and make my battle. Look at what we're battling here on with through National Liberty Alliance under the grand jury processes. What we're battling here is really getting justice back into our courts, which will solve all these problems as time goes on if we can win back our courts. You know, look at, we have government by the consent of the people, and we the people consent whether in our courts, whether guilty or innocent, we the people consent whether to give an indictment or not. We the people consent on the political processes through the committee man. But we don't have any of those powers. They've taken it away. They've robbed us of it, and they've been they're held by just a few. And so that's where our battle is. But let me ask you a question. Do you have a question for Brent? Because this is Brent's time for a couple of people who have some questions. Do you have a question for Brent? As far as the court case goes, you know, we can't really give you too much advice on that, except for what I just gave you. I mean, again, it could be a learning process, but it could be a very dangerous place, too. Once you start to see these people get vindictive, you need to think about what you're doing here.
Well, of course I am. The reason I'm doing it, in fact, there are other cases. Like, for example, they're trying to steal our home place. So I've been experiencing that. And I actually contacted you all before initially. I was referred to you because of the matter concerning my grandmother, which was pulled or kidnapped by DSS, and we actually unfortunately experienced a wrongful death of my grandmother as a result of that activity. So I have seen the hostility and the evil wickedness and the injustice or tyranny. And I'm just trying to understand, based on the things that you all are doing, are there documents or what suggestions would you offer in terms of how
we don't really get into the details of how to defend yourself in these things and to go through certain, you know, teachings of that type. You know, we have to be careful, especially even if we wanted to do those things. But we don't get involved in too much into that. What we're trying to do is getting people involved in trying to save the nation by coming together as the people to require these people to obey the law. And we have to do it up on the federal level, because if you could do it on the federal level and take control of the courts, if the people can take back control of the courts and require the people to obey the law at that level, we could do it in every state of the union ultimately, because, you know, we can come into any court and deal with a court from the federal level, mostly because it's a violation of an unalienable right of due process. And it's always that. It's always a jurisdiction concern and a violation of due process. And it's exactly what you got going on with the court you're dealing with right now. Again, it's a jurisdiction problem and it's a due process problem. And they don't have jurisdiction and you're not getting due process. And that's what makes it a federal offense. But there is a group out there called Your Remedy is the Law, and they get into little different things and ideas on how they can fight this battle. But I'll tell you, some of those remedies can get you in more trouble than you're really bargaining for. And again, you know, it could work for one person, and it could work for them a couple of times. You get the wrong judge, woke up on the wrong side of the bed or something, let me tell you something, you're going to have a problem. So you want to be careful in what you're doing. And again, I say put your energies into learning the processes, learning the Constitution, learning American history, learning common law, learning the history of common law, learning the things that will give you power and authority, and work with the people trying to get control of the courts and bring these people back under the authority of the people through the chains of the Constitution. You know, that's what we're trying to do, and that's what we need to get. But anyway, let me move on, because Brent doesn't have much more time with us. Do you have a question for Brent?
I don't know what else I would ask. I don't know how to ask him the question based on the things he talked about, but those are the issues.
Well, yeah, but go ahead. Did you want to comment on
that? Well, yeah, just respond real quick, but just from all the things that you said, sounds like that they're saying things that aren't true. The affidavit truly is pretty strong, and if you put one in, an affidavit correcting the false statements of the government. If you really believe they're false, put an affidavit in, put exhibits on the back of it, and refer to those. Remember, an affidavit is not your opinion. It has to be something you know to be fact. You're stating facts. You're not stating any conclusions. You're not saying this is right, this is wrong. You're just saying this is the fact of the matter, and then see Exhibit A, and then have Exhibit A on the back. I do have a valid driver's license, or whatever it is you want. Now, there's some things that don't have exhibits. You can put them on there. Once you do that, that doesn't prove the fact. But that puts it in front of the court, and then that allows you, if they want, the other side can cross-examine you on your affidavit. And that is part of our due process. That wouldn't hurt. It's important to put something on the record to correct errors that the government has made in a criminal case. And this is a criminal case, albeit not an infamous crime, but they're trying to accuse you of a misdemeanor or something a little more. I don't know what it is, but it's a traffic crime of some kind. And it's important that if you don't correct what they've said, what they said to be true will stand. You got to correct it. Even if you lose, make sure you make a record. You know, in America, even if we lose, it's our tradition. It's our tradition, even when we hang people, that we allow them to say something before we strike them. All of us have the right to speak, and that affidavit is your right to correct the lies. By the way, that book I mentioned a while ago, Billy Budd, that's what happened in that case. He was at Captain's Mast. Captain's Mast is a drumhead court that sailors use, and there is no jury, and the master at arms on the ship was accusing Billy Budd of mutinous talk, and Billy Budd was a stutterer. He never mastered it, and when he got emotionally upset, he couldn't talk, and he couldn't talk. Here he was being tried for his life, and he had an impediment that wouldn't let him speak. And so he didn't know what to do. Well, in your case, and of course it wasn't possible at the Captain's Mast in Billy Budd's case, but you can put in a written document. I know people I've been in court with and helped them and give them an affidavit. We've gone through it, hammered it out. And I've discovered that some people get into court, and even if they're good talkers, when they get into court, they can't talk very well. They freeze up, get nervous. I understand that. I've been that way myself a lot. But if you get it on paper and get it in the record, there it is. And that is usually something you can do. So I would suggest that you at least, as a pro se litigant, you must correct the errors of statement of the government.
Okay. I guess that's the truth. I have done some of that, but I guess I will do it again. The way I was hearing was just say what the truth is. And once you say what the truth is, then I know that once I tell, once I say the truth, it's up to God at that point. I have already spoken, but I understand what you're saying in terms of putting in an affidavit form.
Yes, and there may be a statute that says your affidavit has to be in this form, but in any case, it's nice to have it notarized if it doesn't hurt. And then the court says, okay, the law says you're serious. You're putting yourself on the line here a little bit. You're making yourself vulnerable to perjury. That's what you're doing. But if you believe they're wrong, they're dead wrong, an affidavit is what you need. Go to the internet and get a form that is an affidavit and swear. And it has to have a jurat at the end, a jurat, J-U-R-A-T. That means a statement like, I sign this under penalties of perjury, or I believe these things to be true. Yeah, go look up the word jurat, and you'll see what a jurat is. You can probably find those on the internet, too. The internet's a great tool. It's changed everything in the law, because now people can go to the internet, and they can find the forms to actually go to court. And before, you couldn't do that very easy without going to the courthouse. But on the internet, we're just in a better position. And that's why the courts, they're overwhelmed. They're upset. What we need, this gives me an opportunity to voice my convictions, we need a lot more judges, a lot more courts, Our population is growing, and we're not keeping up. And the courts, instead of going to court, we're dependent on government bureaucrats to solve our problems with our neighbors. No, we need courts. We need courts, just like in the Bible, right down to the township level, right down lower than that even. We need little courts. At the glory of the common law, said Blackstone. Always was the glory of the common law. It brought a court to every cottage. Within a short distance of every cottage in old England, there were the 100 courts. We brought the 100 courts to America. All of Pennsylvania was organized by the hundreds. The only state that still has hundreds is New Jersey, the way I understand it. But they're nothing more now than just window dressing. But they still have them as an entity within the county. You have counties, townships, and hundreds. But those 100 courts were about every 100 people had a court. That's the way it ought to be. There's nothing wrong with that. There's everything right about it. It's hard now to get into court. If men can't settle their differences between themselves and their differences between them and the government, then there's nothing left. There's nothing left if they can't do it in court but oppression. That's all that's left. Our courts are important, and it is our duty as Americans and our common law tradition, and you're doing this the way you thought, to be polite in court. Because if we don't, we must volunteer. We respect the courts in America. We respect the robes of the judges. And again, I know that they go awry. I know that they go plumb rogue and crazy. But it is part of our common law tradition that we respect the courts. Even the Bible says, it's a good Bible on this, you don't talk back to judges. The Bible says don't do that. I don't do it when I'm in court. And it's not because I respect the judges. As a matter of fact, in a lot of cases, I don't. I know what they are. But God says, respect the office. Mm-hmm. Respect the office. I had a lot of military officers I had little respect for. But I had sworn to respect the office. And I did, and I feel good about it. And I encourage you to do the same thing. And like I say, it sounds like you do. I encourage all of you. If we respect anything in America, the Bible says, respect all men. Honor all men. Love the brotherhood. That's a little different. Fear God. Honor the king. Honor all men. And one of the places we can do that is in the courts. I've been to courts before where, in federal courts, by the way, where we're in trial. And the jury walks in, the judge stands up. The jury walks in, the judge stands up. Everybody walks in, the jury walks in last. I've been in federal courts where it's just the other way around. Everybody walks in, and then the judge walks in, we all stand up. That tells you something, doesn't it? Well, I just tell that story as a reminder to us how we're supposed to think in America as Americans, and what our freedoms depend upon. It depends upon the way we think. Our common law is a way of thinking. Well, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. And I hope you do well. Good luck.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, let's take our next person. Is Gene from Florida. Go right ahead, Gene. You got a question or a comment for Brent? Or someone anonymous. Maybe that's not Gene.
Yes, hello?
Who's calling? Yeah, go right ahead. Who's calling? What's your first name and state?
This is El Adonia, or you can call me Gene, out of Miami, Florida.
Okay, Gene from Florida. Go right ahead.
I didn't mean to veer off on what Brent was basically speaking about. I just had a question. Now that I was wondering, okay, from last time when I spoke to you, it was like, whatever it is, because I've got this, the charge with the Zannies or whatever. You're like, if it's something where they're asking for time, try to just go ahead and just get the probation and get it over it. But now I do go ahead and get the probation, right, so then I could still appeal it, correct, and try to fight it that way?
Well, look at
go ahead, John, go ahead.
Yeah, my strategy is very simple. You know, do the best you can to stay out of jail. I mean, if you could fight it, and you know, you do what you want to do. But look at, if you know you're facing jail, you do everything you can to stay out of it, and then you can continue to fight through the appeal, and you can make the point that you did what you did under stress and duress and so on. You know, when I get a traffic ticket or anything of that nature, it's very simple for me. I have a paper that I pretty much write. It's pretty much the same all the time, but, you know, I just detail it around whatever it is I'm doing, put an affidavit to it and send it in. And half the time it works and half the time it doesn't. Half the time it doesn't work, it's not worth for me to battling any further. And I pay the ticket and I put it into a folder, and I think one day I may go back and sue them all in one shot, but not now, when I have time, when we get to the other side. But Brent, you want to respond to that too?
Well, no, I like what you said. I do believe it is important to pick your battles, and if you're in jail, it's hard to fight. I know that for a fact. But I was going to caution you, don't make a deal. If you want to appeal, don't do a plea bargain. A plea bargain is going to make it almost impossible to appeal. There are exceptions, but don't do the plea bargain.
But remember, Brent, from last time when I was telling you guys that I did a writ of discovery, a jurisdictional challenge, a petition, a judicial notice, and a criminal complaint as stating all the facts, and you guys were like, they might know that they're so wrong that they might just find me guilty because the court doesn't like when they're, like, completely wrong.
And
I think you guys were like, well, just see if you can get probation and see if you can fight it on the other level. And at the same time, that's me trying to get this case out of the way, basically for the fact of the original case that I'm going through, which where they sent me to prison for driving with a suspended license. I was coming from work, lost my house, lost my daughter, lost the car, lost my girl. And I put the appeal on. It went up to the District Court of Appeals, and they dismissed it. So that's the main thing that I'm trying to stay focused on, at least trying to come back. And I think one of you guys are letting me know that that's the case. As long as I'm in the GJA course, I can go ahead and fight that, which right now, how can I actually get involved? I'm like at about like 96%. I'm almost done. I have been calling some of the peoples just to figure out, you know, what can I do to get involved as far as let me see here, Pinellas County, Marion, Seminole, and I just can't find anybody. I've been calling Doug, Paul, Rebecca. Now, I have came across with Lydia, but Miss Lydia is very, very busy, so she can only call me when she gets a chance.
You're talking about
Lawyer. How can I get actually, you know? I had a call, email me, said he was going to call me, but I haven't received no call yet.
Look at what you need to do is just get involved with the people in general on a national level. You'll find people on a local level and work things in if that's what you're talking about. You talk about Lydia out of New York City?
I didn't know. I thought she was somewhere in Florida. I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
She's out of New York City, that Lydia. And she could be very helpful in different ways, but she doesn't understand common law, but she's very active. And she gets some success because she's very active and dogmatic. But look at, you know, getting connected. We got a lot of people down in Florida. And what you want to do is help build the ranks up in your county. If there aren't many people in your county, bring people from
the
religious
groups. No, it's not. I've
been
trying to call people and everything. And the only person I've got in contact was Miss Lydia. And that was when I went ahead and called for the Elvira and Rolando Ramirez case.
Right. Yeah, they're all working up in New York City.
I went ahead and called and tried to make an opinion about that.
Look,
what
you want to do is participate in the process. We're trying to get more people in. We're trying to reach critical mass. It's not just the people that are already in the game. It's the people that you can bring into the game, so to speak. There are people in liberty groups around you. Introduce them to what we're doing. Get them to read our front page. Get them to watch the videos. Get them to understand what we're doing. Get them to work with you. Get a committee of safety going and start the process in your county, building the ranks. And then you'll find people that are already in that maybe are silent, and then they'll come out of the woodwork and say, oh, yeah, I'm a member also in L.A., because all our members aren't listed that you can get to them. Only the people who decide to list their names are, you know, and their phone numbers are being seen, and that's a lot of our leadership. But anyway, that's the way to do it.
That's the reason why I've been actually trying to call, because the certain people that I have been coming across and trying to, preach the gospel, and a lot of them are scared, and they're like, they're amping me up and saying, go, yeah. And in a minute, I'm like, yeah, I need you too. And it's like, So a lot of people think what I'm doing is absurd, thinking to be trying to get to contacting with the sheriffs or whatever and going against they feel like I'm trying to go against the government, and a lot of people are scared.
That also is a problem, and you got to ask yourself the question, what are you involved in, and what are you doing that is bringing you under this kind of a problem? Is it how far do you want to go? Again, you got to choose your battles. There's so many problems out here. You'll be fighting all the time. You go to jail for this or getting fined for that. You got to try to work things out to do the best you can. Do everything you can to stay out of jail. Sometimes it's just easy to pay the toll, so to speak, and look, I'll come back later and deal with this, and I'll deal with these people if that's what you want to do. You put it in a folder. But the thing is get involved in solving the problem. National Liberty Alliance is trying to solve the problem. It's a people problem. The people need to fix the problem. Only the people can fix it. We've got to come in critical mass. We've got to come uniformed. We've got to come working from every county, organized in every county. We've got to become educated. There's so much to do. Do those things.
And right now I'm unemployed and I'm still job hunting. That's why I've been trying to get involved and see what ways I can do to get more knowledge and as well being involved to make it a little bit stronger as far as, trying to get involved with the Committee of Safety, But I have been trying to call people and I haven't been getting in contact. Nobody really ever called me back. Lydia's the only one that I've actually spoken to. But, I've been trying to do that there as well.
All right. Well, again, you can get onto the other committees. There's committees that work together that is national level committees, and you do all your work over the internet, working with people coming together in meetings like this and doing different things. But the Committee of Safety is really the big push right now, and also the administration for the grand jury. We're always looking for administrators for that process. So, but let me go to the next call. Appreciate your time and. Just be careful and do the best you can to stay out of jail. That's the key.
All right, thanks.
And that's the hard part too. Sometimes. All right, Brent. I'm gonna push this over to Gerard now. And
thanks
for your
Tom.
Time. And we'll see you next week.
You
Gerard,
bet.
You here?
See you.
Thank you, Gerard. I hope he's here.
John.
Yep.
We had Gary Will. Agreed to step up and talk a little about his setting up committees of safety before Gerard starts. Is that okay to do now?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay.
Just unmute him and let him come up there.
Okay, if I can find him here.
John, am I unmuted?
Yes, yeah, Brent. No, you're not muted. You're unmuted, yeah.
Well, I need you to mute me so I won't make any noise. I can't make it
work
this year.
All right.
Thanks.
Star 6 isn't working on you?
Not right now for some reason. I got a new phone thing. That's the problem.
All right. Let me click on you. You should be muted in a second. You're muted now. So if you're
Gary,
talking,
are you unmuted?
We're not hearing. So.
Okay.
Hey, how you doing, Gary?
Yeah, John. We made a trip up to Wisconsin this week on Tuesday. We did 3 meetings up there. People were excited. I'm surprised at the number of young people that are involved or want to be involved. But anyway, we set up 2 counties. The one county we filled out, we're short 1 member. In 1 county, and the 3rd county was to be wrapped up this week. The reason for that is we didn't have the paperwork ready, and so we had to get back with them. Saturday or Sunday, can't remember, went down to Indiana, Valparaiso, and helped NLA member down there by the name of Bob Cagle. He had a good meeting. There were a number, again, young people there, 18 to 20-some years old, and also more some older people, too. But the young people are really coming out, and I was very surprised. He's 1 short on 1 county, and the other county, the 18-year-old went home and told his dad about it, and he says, I'll be the chairman, and so that county will be filled out, too. So that's Portage and Lake County down, that's northern Indiana. The meetings went very well. People were excited and listened, and it excited us, too. So that was the extent of it, essentially 5 counties in a week in 2 states. So that's
this is great news, and you and I had spoke before about this, and it's really, getting out there. For the people that are getting out there to doing what Gary is doing and doing what some others are doing is really trying to work the committees of safety, not only in their own counties, but the counties around them and throughout their state. that's what we all have to be doing. And we appreciate hearing these kind of things. And if anybody else has wants to share with us their experience concerning getting out there, building the committees of safety, and maybe some ideas of some of the things they're doing, you know, you're welcome to bring that up. Did you want to add anything else to that,
Well,
Gary?
I think having others speak up too is very important, especially in the initial stages, because so many people are hesitant. They have fears. They don't know how to go about it. They think they have to have a huge meeting and so on and so forth. And we're finding out, you know, the excitement. We're operating a three-state territory, so to speak, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Illinois. And those comments on our calls speared on quite a bit of excitement. We're getting a lot more activity. I expect a lot more in the future. And I expect these to bleed over into other counties, because if you approach the problems properly, we've got two people in Illinois. They're called the Edgar County Watchdogs. They've been active for about 4 years, and about 4 years ago, they decided there were problems with our government, and so they took on a park board. They actually made a citizen's arrest because they knew the sheriff, and they blocked them off, and the sheriff came out and arrested them. But since that time, they have gained recognition throughout the state, and they walk into a board today, and the board leaves out the back door. And they're down in southern Illinois now, and they've gone to two meetings. They live in central Illinois. They've driven down in two meetings. They've gone out the back door. They don't want to face them. And, of course, that they recognize that's fraud big time. And they've, over the last 4 years, I think there's 200 or so government officials that have either resigned their jobs or they're forced out or one of the other things. They got rid of the chair or the president of DuPage College. They gave him the board, awarded him a $750,000 retirement package. And these guys got involved. He got fired. They saved the $750,000, and the board was totally replaced. So that's the kind of power they have, and I know the guys, and I think between us, and I know other states have similar things, and they've been at it longer than we have, and they know how to pull FOIA requests and open meeting requests and how to follow the money, and they do give training sessions. So hopefully we can work together, because they don't have a common law grand jury in their situation. They've had to sue quite a few times to get the FOIAs and that. And right now, I think they're going to get rid of the Auditor General of Illinois, a guy named Frank Martino. So they're really, really active and really doing a great job. So, but that's all I have to do, and you know, and you just need to get out there and talk to people. That's all you need to do, and you know, we're just protecting our families as well as our neighbors' families. Simply that's all we're doing, and of course we can go much beyond that. But there shouldn't
be protecting each other. United we stand, and divided we fall.
And that's all we're doing. And but people are so hesitant to make decisions. But that's really all we're doing, and I find that loosens them up a little bit, because they try to complicate it. But that's initially all we're doing. Now we can go well beyond that, but the initial step, that's it. And that's all I have, John, unless anybody has any questions.
All right. Appreciate your time, Gary. Thank you.
You bet.
Okay. Gerard, you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, you got the mic. Just click the next question. I think Gene should fall off, and you'll pick up David there. There it is. You got it. There's David. 215.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, David, Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. And by the way, I'm probably about 20 miles outside the city, John. But unfortunately not far enough, so I'm working on that, trying to move upstate. But anyway, this question is for John. I believe it was last week, you were talking about NLA needing funds. Well, I might have an idea there. I'd like to at least run by you, and you can, you know, take a look at it and let me know what you think and
whatever.
Right,
if you want to give me a call tomorrow, we can discuss it. You know, I'm always very careful about how we might get funds. A lot of people had some ideas, and we just didn't want to go down that route.
Yeah,
and we just got to be really, really careful. And, you know, we're just looking for enough money to pay the bills and to give us the money to do what we have to do. I mean, bills have been pretty tough the last couple of months, and, you know, we're close to – we were pretty much paid up the bills last month, but this month I don't know how it's going to work. We'll find out in another 10 days whether we're going to be able to pay all the bills. But today, you know, we had to put $100 into mailing that kind of wasn't counting on. We don't have any extra money coming in for the mailing for the cases, but – that's what we spent in the mailing for just the Oregon case. There's some pretty heavy packages, quite a few, and we had to serve a few, and then we sent another copy down to an interesting party that's a very interesting individual. We're not going to get into details, who's interested in what we're doing. And and hopefully, you know, we'll be able to benefit from that. But anyway, yeah, money's tough, and you know, we're trying to sell some things. We have a lot of products up there for sale. That's good stuff. Some of them we don't have. We haven't opened it up yet for sale because we still haven't finished some of the problems. You know, like take the radios for right now. We're working on a few different things, and we have to have the people that are working on the hams give us the right formula so we can program the radios and make sure we have the right radios to do what it is that we want to do, and then we'll start selling them. I mean, I wish we could have started selling them 3 weeks ago when we kind of unfolded this thing. But right. To also realize that we need to also offer certain accessories. And we want to be minimum on those things, but yet we want to give the best product and give something that's reasonable on cost. So anyway, okay, look, give me a call during the day tomorrow, 845-233-6560. That's 845-233-6560. And, you know, maybe late morning, and maybe we can talk a little bit about what's on your mind. If you can't get me and you try me a few times and you can't get me, get a hold of one of the national leaders. You'll find them in the directory. And tell them that, you know, that I was expecting to connect with you. They'll find me, you know, get me on my cell or something. Okay?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, I forgot his name already. The guy that spoke earlier.
Brent.
I'd just like to say, Brent, I could probably sit and listen to you all day. It's pretty good stuff there. But anyway, all right, thanks, and I'll call you.
Go read the book, Common Law.
Yeah, okay, I'll do that.
Excellence in the Common Law. I tell you, for me, the first time reading it, you know, there was a lot I missed, so to speak. I was kind of learning at the time anyway. But as you're picking up some of these things and you're learning other things and you go back and read a second time, all of a sudden you see, wow, I missed all this, and all this great stuff.
Right.
So
okay.
And like anything else, you know. He's done some good research there, in-depth stuff, and it seems like you can read through it numerous times and pick up more and more every time you go through it. So it's a great book, and it really assists us in understanding common law.
Right. Oh, by the way, I've been following as much information as I could get on the Oregon situation and the Bundy family and stuff, and it's just, you know, so when you were talking about...
It's an atrocity out there. We the people need to get up. And by the way, let me put the word out. We're going to be calling for people to get active in these cases, so let's get ready to get active. We're going to want phone calls, faxing. We're going to want people who are out in the neighborhood that can get down and get to some of these cases. We want them there in the courtrooms. We want to become active. We want to let them know that we, the people, are there. We're watching, and we're expecting to get justice here. And certainly justice is not being applied by going after these people who are really the real thugs is the BLM. Those are the people that need to go to jail. And Congress agrees with us. We've got a paper we filed with this with these papers that we read tonight. Congress agrees with us.
Right. So one question.
The Congress doesn't have the backbone to do anything, though. They don't.
Right.
You know, look, the committee worked on it, and they were very strong and powerful in their thoughts and their words. And when they took it to the body, it didn't go nowhere because they don't have any spine.
Right. Now, did they determine who assassinated Lavoie Finicum? Was it a state official or was it at Fed?
I would be guessing. You know, some people will say certain things, and you know who actually did the certain shots. I mean, there are even people who think that there were actually mercenaries on that thing dressed up.
Right, I heard that too. Yeah.
Lady. So I don't know what the truth is on the individuals. But look at once we turn this thing around and we get to this court case focused where it really belongs to be focused, we're going to start getting names. We're going to start discovering what really happened because once you put the pressure on the people and the people have a duty to speak and they're going to be held liable and in the conspiracy. If you don't want to be in the conspiracy, you don't want to be liable to this thing, you better speak up and let us know what's going on. People start talking.
Yeah.
Believe me.
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
Okay. Gerard, you got it. Anybody wants to get into the queue, star six. But go ahead, Gerard.
Okay. We got, it didn't go. Hang on. Let me hit it again. There we go. California. It looks like Donaldson, if that's correct. You've been unmuted. 2412, last four numbers.
I am here, and I just had to unmute myself.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call. I trust all is well, everybody. I wrote some notes real quick, so let me just go quickly to the note of my question, which has to do with the Fifth Amendment, okay? And it has to do with the militia clause in the Fifth Amendment. So the question is, I guess, directed to Brent or anyone else that's willing to take the question. I want to know what happens with the immunity provided by the Fifth Amendment if the militia are called forth and in a time of public danger.
All right, let me see if Brent is still here. Let me see if he's still at his computer. Let me unmute him. I'll let Brent answer that if he wants. Brent, do you want to answer that question?
If you can hear me, apparently you can.
Yeah, I can hear you.
The question, the way I understood it was, is there immunity for militiamen once they're called into actual service? Is that the question?
No, that's not really the question.
Oh.
Well, it's a common understanding that as free men and women here, as Americans, we don't have to, right, Brent, incriminate ourselves. We're not corporations. We're not under corporate law. We have no duty of incrimination, and no indictment can be presented, right? Except, what's the actual text there of the Fifth Amendment? Oh goodness, I have it somewhere.
I don't have it in front of me either.
No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment, right, or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, I'm asking about that. So what happens now to my immunity there? Am I right to not be held against my will and, in the case of a time of public danger, especially if the militia are called forth?
I hope I hit the nail on the head. I'm not sure exactly what you're going at here, but if the militia are called forth mustered, the militiamen, it becomes would come under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. If the President of the United States summoned the militia or any part thereof, when the President has concurrent jurisdiction with the governors of each state according to the militia clauses, and whoever calls them up first has them. By analogy, I like to cite the example of President Eisenhower. He called up the National Guard. That's not the militia, I understand that, by analogy, but he called up the National Guard in Arkansas back during the days of civil rights unrest, 1954, I believe this is during the Brown versus Board case,
he called up the National Guard. He did it quickly so that the governor wouldn't do it, and that's constitutional. Whoever calls up the guard first, it's the same. The guard is not the militia. I have to repeat that, but it's the same principle, and the militia of the several states is under that principle also. If the governor calls them up first, he's got them. He has jurisdiction over them. And once they're called up and mustered, Justice Story makes much of this in his commentaries, they must, militiamen under summons, on the way to being mustered, is still not under the military law, the martial law. But once he musters, he falls in ranks and says present, and when they holler out his name, then at that point, he's under the military law, and he's not entitled necessarily even to a jury. It depends upon the circumstances, although our court martials often have one, and it's a good thing they do, as long as a drumhead court on the field of battle may not have time to do all those things. Circumstances may not allow it. But the civilian court, I don't like these words civilian, the common law courts, as long as they're open, says our Supreme Court, even in time of war, the military courts don't have jurisdiction over non-members, folks that are not serving in the military, including militia. That was the case back in Indiana. They arrested right after the war between the states, or not long after, they arrested a fellow in Indiana, tried him at the federal military base in Indianapolis. I believe it was Fort Ben Harrison. Sentenced him to hang, and he appealed. He said, you can't do this. Military, I'm not a military man, and the civilian or the common law courts are open, and the Supreme Court went all the way up. They agreed with him and wrote a long opinion about it. That's the difference. I hope I've said something that was worthwhile to you. The Fifth Amendment, you have to have more.
Yeah, I have another question for you if you're ready.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, here's this question I've been thinking about. Are the police the militia, you see, that are being called forth by the state, somehow by these municipalities? Because I've noticed in San Francisco they have, like, the municipality who then calls forth through its police powers different groups of people who patrol the streets and look for issues that the city deems to be needing attention.
And but if they're receiving a page,
sometimes these people are of less credible character, let's put it that way.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's really interesting to see, you know, sometimes criminals, you know, or drug addicts actually out there policing other drug addicts and dressed up in the using police power. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, if I think a misuse, if it is the militia, police as the militia, can you imagine the possibility? What is that even possible? Sir,
the police,
do you think that's true? Yeah.
Well, if you're getting a government paycheck, you're not the part of the militia. Now, that's not to say a militiaman can't be paid for his services. But if you're not, you've not been mustered, and you're getting a government paycheck, you're just a government employee. You're a clerk, as they used to say, and you're there bound by the intricacies and the strictness of the regulations you're under. That's supposedly the way it's supposed to work. But you're not a militia member. Now, a police officer could become a militia member. His job down, I suppose, mm-hmm. Join the militia. But the militia is there so that we won't have a standing paid army. That's what the whole idea of the four militia clauses of our Constitution is.
Cool. One thing I did. Sorry about that. I just thank you for the answer. One thing I did to try, I guess I did it inadvertently, was there was some sort of protest going on, and so I made up these committee of safety flyers, right? I said, start a committee of safety, and I was telling them all the reasons why, and I put some case law down there, right, and hitting all the good points. And I went down to the police station where the protest was, and all the protesters were gone. And so I just went into the police station and asked for the sergeant and handed it to the sergeant. But it was in the midst of, like, the whole, like, propaganda about police shootings and stuff, so I think you know, they were a bit scared, and they came out, two of them came out actually kind of upset looking and wondered what I wanted, you know. And,
I would suggest you don't talk to those people anymore.
I gave them what I did was I gave them this piece of paper, which was basically giving them instructions and advising them to start their own committee of safety, which me, that's what it would work out to be, the equivalent of me giving them a flyer, information they can use to start their own committee of safety. So I highly recommend that to people who want to get down with that kind of plan too, because those people are going to need help when it comes down to it as well, right? Police officers are also just human beings. So,
yeah.
All right, thanks for the question. We're going to move on because we haven't got that much time. We've got a few callers still in the queue, so, okay? Thank you. Gerard, go ahead, take the mic.
Okay.
I'll mute you again, Brent.
This is Stephanie, and this was for Brent.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, we had asked on the sheriff's meeting what you do if a sheriff doesn't do his duty that he's supposed to do, just like with Ryan Bundy out there. And I was listening to a Facebook thing that Kelly was on and was asking for help out there because they said that they're trying to get the bullet out of Ryan's shoulder because it's evidence that the FBI shot at them with real bullets. So as far as the jurisdiction, it seems to me that those sheriffs are part of the law of the city and not of God's law, common law. And so what do you do about those sheriffs? And do you use the militia with the people to do something, to make something happen? How does it work?
Do you want me to respond to that?
Please.
All right, well, look, right now it's a mess out there. And, trying to fix this, there's so many different problems. The best thing to do is, again, you start your committee of safety, work there. Meanwhile, become friends with the sheriff, and pass with him information that will educate him. And especially for sheriffs that are totally uneducated, like the sheriff out there in Oregon right now, out there in Portland, I forget the name of the county, Monmouth County or something like that. Obviously, that sheriff is not a very educated sheriff. He does not understand the Constitution. He doesn't understand his duty. He doesn't understand his oath he took. He doesn't understand what it is to be a sheriff. He may have a few of these points right somewhere here or there, of course, but generally speaking, he doesn't understand it, and he doesn't have the right mindset, and that, of course, is a major problem. So we have to deliver this information. We do have a 39-page paper that would be one of the first things you want to give the sheriff, which empowers him, okay? He should be reading that and saying, wow, I didn't, it's going to empower him. The other thing also is to start sharing with the sheriff. Remember, you're trying to befriend the sheriff. That's the key. If you're going to go, you get more with honey than you do with vinegar, okay? So you want to sort of put the honey out there. You're looking to befriend him. Then you want to share with him what exactly you're doing as the Committee of Safety. You want to get copies of the handbook that you have. Give it to the sheriff so he understands what you're doing and how it's forming and where it came from. You might want to get them the resolution, of course, and the charter, okay? Every committee has to start off with a charter, so you want to give them the charter. You want to give them the resolution. With all those things that you've given him as an education, and as he reads through all this stuff, he's going to be seeing and hearing different things that he's never really thought about before. And hopefully that's going to start to bring him around to a different direction. Unless he's a hardened criminal. Look, there are some people in the police force, sheriffs are no different. They're in it for the corruption. And there's other things going on here. They could be into drugs themselves and moving drugs and protecting criminals. All that is real. That could happen. And sheriffs generally don't get lost. I don't think this happens with sheriffs often, but that could happen. But the point is really, as long as he's not a hardened criminal himself, you have a good opportunity to turn him, and you're using logic to make the point. And once he starts to really see the power and the real true authority of the sheriff and the duty of the sheriff and the responsibility of the sheriff and what the people are doing and starting to see that there is danger around the corner, there is a monetary collapse coming around the corner. Look at anybody that doesn't know this, just is not paying attention at all. Just about almost everyone will agree when you say, hey, look, we're heading for some kind of an economic or monetary collapse. Everyone will agree. I mean, I haven't met anyone yet these days. I mean, years ago, maybe not. But today, everybody knows. You can look around the world and see what's going on. That's where I would go with this. Then when you have your first real meeting with the sheriff, you've educated him. See, every meeting wants to be very short, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, getting on the phone, dropping something off, having a cup of coffee, and not getting too much into conversation, more listening to what he has to say, tell him why you're here, and ask him a few questions and let him talk. But you're feeding him the information. And when you get him to the real meeting where he's now going to come, maybe bring a few deputies if he wants, and you're going to get him there for an hour or two, and he's come to the meeting and now he's listening, and now you're going to really bring the whole thing about, and then he's going to get up and talk, and now we're going to see now where he goes at that point. And I think you can win most every sheriff over if you do it that way. But if you're going to go after the sheriff and go focusing in on his sins and his problems and his lack of knowledge and his incompetency and his lack of duty and all these other things, you're never going to bring him through. But some of the worst,
well,
you'd be surprised.
We have
be
done the
quote.
Duty and brought the education to him for the last 3 years, and he's thrown it in the garbage and violated people.
Right, that's a whole different – but I understand what you're saying. This is a major problem. Because we've been trying to do this with every sheriff in America, and you're right. We get some sheriffs that have been throwing our stuff in the garbage because they have no clue. First of all, they've been misinformed on who we are, okay? So right there, they think, oh, these guys are crazy. They don't know, have a clue what we're doing. But, you see, what we're talking about now is the Committee of Safety coming with an authority, coming with you're coming with a charter and a seal and a resolution. And you're working in the community, and he sees this also as potential people to hopefully reelect him. He sees this as community support. He sees you as leveraging. You got to give him a different perspective and a different point of view. Right now, you're trying to get the sheriff on board with a situation out west, particularly, and you're talking about the Oregon situation, I presume, and you're talking about the sheriff of Monmouth County, right?
Well, we've talked to him about that, but we've also talked to him about his due process because we have a lot of Native Americans here that have their kids taken in 20-second hearings.
Right, but what I'm trying to tell you is this. Listen to what I'm trying. You're getting into an issue and a problem that he unfortunately has a point of view and a political position on, and also there's people talking in his ear and people he's having lunch with or playing golf with or whatever the case may be, okay? When you're approaching him from that kind of a level, you're going to get what you get. You're not going to change his spot, so to speak. But when you approach him in a neutral way, from a different perspective, as befriending him from the point of view of you trying to empower him on the one hand, and him starting to see this group of people as an empowerment and also as a base for reelecting him, it's a whole different thing. When you're trying to really feed him without an issue, if you're going to come to him with an issue, we have a situation of one story where a guy comes and he's talking to him about trying to get the sheriff to do the right thing, and he's talking to him, trying to pull him into what he wants to do, but he's also bringing his personal concerns. Now, he's got an issue. The issue gets in the way. It'll always get in the way. So if you're dealing with the issue and everybody's already settled on their sides and the sheriff is settled on his side, it's going to be real hard to change his side. But you can change his point of view on that if you take a different approach and you befriend him and you educate him in a way that is neutral and you're not forcing him into anything and you're really trying to communicate with him. You're trying to share with him what we the people are trying to do in the community, and he sees it growing and he sees and understands what you're doing and he's educating. Now it's a whole different issue. Now when you get him to the meeting, you bring him into the place where you really want to get him, which is to take his hand back up and take that oath a lot more serious. Now when the issue comes, he's now in a different position altogether now. Now he's got a conflict in his mind where he's got to deal with now. He's now learned the real truth, because once you have the real truth, the lie falls away, and it becomes more of a problem to try to hold up, and he may just turn. Again, now you're talking about the fiber of a man, and you're talking about other things, but again, where is the real political power? Is it with his buddies, with the judges and those guys, or is it with the people? When you're hanging out with the people for a while, you realize these are the people that are supporting me. These are the people who are going to get me back into the election. This is where I need to be. You see, you gotta, it's a new process. You got to befriend the sheriff.
Don't forget, you can run a new sheriff to also. He's a political animal. So if your committees of safety are people in the community, believe me, out of all the authority out there, the sheriff pay attention to the local people. So if you amass local people and he thinks you're going to run somebody against him or do a recall, that's one way of taking a corrupt sheriff out and turning him back the other way because they're political animals. He's the highest law enforcement official because he's elected by the people. So unelect him. Use the process and become the committee man. Even if you're not committee man, go carry petitions. They understand that and they fear that. You know, unlike when you get a bunch of contractors, you know, one of the problems they have during chaos is they hire government contractors who have no authority. It's just as bad as if they bring in the UN troops. Those guys have no authority. They're enemies. You know, the sheriff is elected by the people. You have that control over him, and that's why you have to concentrate on the sheriff, because that's where the authority is. You can't do much about a contractor that comes in. You know, what are you going to do? A contractor is a foreign enemy. I mean, the only thing you can do with a contractor breaking the law, I hate to say it, is you go to war with him. And if they bring contractors in, that's what they're asking for. Your sheriff, you can replace him using the political process, using peer pressure and people. That's what they understand. Believe me, and they understand when people in their community amass, they want to be there because they know they won't get reelected. So it's important to understand that point of authority being the sheriff.
Well, you know, as listening to Brent, I've been listening to his Liberty lineup too, and studying those 136 things he's talking about there, and bringing the militia in there, because just like they've got quotas for prisoners, and so if they've got an empty cell, there's a contractor that's out there that gets the money, and the state gets matching federal money, so it's all about putting people in prison for the $4.1 billion of big farm money. You know, we're the second most corrupt state in the union. And it's because of all the federal dollars we've got for locking people up, taking people's kids. You know, for a Native American, $8,500 at a minimum is what the state gets for matching. And plus they get all the farm, and they're drugging everybody with psychotropic drugs.
Look, the whole problem gets back to one thing, corporatism, okay? That's what it's all about. You know, when someone was talking earlier, and I was going to pipe in, and I didn't, I decided not to, concerning police officers working for the city or the town or whatever. Look, they're corporate officers. They're working for a corporation. They're not even working for a government agency no more. They may call themselves a government agency, but ultimately they've been shrouded over. They've been veiled over by a corporation, and that's the problem. I was watching something on TV recently, and it was a situation where, you know, on TV, it was a TV program, and a guy was running for sheriff, and he had lost the sheriff thing, and one of the political animals, the politicians that were involved, the big time politician in the town or something, and he approaches the guy from a different perspective, and he says, "Look, we're going to turn this around. We're going to turn this into a city, and we're going to do this, that, or the other thing, and we're going to incorporate, and we're going to need a chief of police, and we're going to put you on as the chief of police." And then the whole thing became a business deal. You see, and that's what they have done with every single county in America. That's what they've done with every state, even the United States itself. They've done it with every municipality, every county, every town, every village. Now, there may be a few here or there that haven't went into the corporate deal, but pretty much almost all have. And we have a serious problem. It's called corporatism. And that is pretty much the same thing as Nazism or Marxism or whatever other ism you want to put out there. Because now it's all about the state. And I'll give you another example of that, okay? Look at the sheriffs here, a few years back when we were doing some battles with the gun issues, and they're trying to get these gun laws, and they're doing this, that, or the other thing, and the sheriffs are standing up and they say, "Hey, we're not gonna yield to that law here in New York." And we had a good success with that for a lot of sheriffs. They kind of got together on that one. We're not going to allow them to do this. But what happened was the legislators tried. I don't know. I guess they haven't accomplished his goal. Somebody must have gotten away with this. But they were moving the control of the guns, you know, of issuing the permits and everything over to the state police. And the state police, they had a press conference, and the question was being asked. You know, to other people, and they asked the question to the commissioner that they had. I think it was a commissioner that they appointed. I think it's called a commissioner. But anyway, the person they appointed for the commissioner of the state police, they said, "Well, look at it. If the governor was to order you to go out and start confiscating guns door to door, would you do it?" He said, "Absolutely will." Okay? There's the difference between someone working for a politician, in this case, ultimately hidden behind that politician is a corporation, because there's money involved. There's money in everything. People go to prison, there's money for everybody. There's money for the judge. There's money for the town. There's money for everybody. And, of course, the prisons have been all privatized. And so it's all about – it's business. It's business. And the people don't know it. It's business. We got to take this and turn it back to the people's business, getting rid of the corporation, getting rid of business, and turn it back to real government, ultimately, the trust of the people working for the, you know, as servants for the people who we elect or hire for these purposes. So what we have to do to fix the problem is the way people are going about is trying to fix the problem. They're doing it, it's not possible from the way that people are trying to do it on that grassroots level from that position. They got to change the whole process. You see, this is, you have to take control of the judicial process, and you take control of the political process. If you take control of the judicial process, you can then take control of the servants, because you can now require them to obey the law or suffer the possibility of being indicted, okay, and therefore removed from office. You see, that is the really where the power is. Now, with the sheriff, again, there's a plan to save America, especially in the hard times, and that is working a deal with your sheriff. But you have to come to your sheriff without an issue. You have to come with him, to him having a relationship, trying to get to know him, for him to get to know you, to share an education with him, and his relationship will be an educational relationship, because you're sharing him information that he doesn't have and he doesn't realize he needs, but as he reads and learns, he's going to understand, I need that, and this is good stuff. That's the relationship that'll develop there. And when the time comes for the principal to stand up on the principal, he's no longer with his pals, maybe. Now he's got issues to deal with that really hit home to him. And he's got to decide, am I going to stand with my friends, the people who befriended me and empowered me and are going to vote for me and support me? And I'm working with the other towns, every town and city in my county, we're working this plan. Or am I going to go with the guys that I've been having lunch with or playing golf with and do the dirty deeds? You see, he's going to have to face that at some point and make the decision. Okay? You're not going to change him any other way. You got to get to this conscience, and first that starts with befriending and being nice, okay? I don't know what else to tell you on this, but we're not going to win the battle the way that people have been trying to win it for 100 years. It hasn't worked. It's still not going to work. We have to go to the core, and that's what we're doing. We're going to the core.
Well, you know, when I look at him, and he, you know, he was a member in church, so I knew him personally. And it seems to me that he's choosing the law of the city, which is corporate.
Because he's got pals, and there's money in it for him. He's got pals and his money. You've got to understand what's going on here. Don't think he's not getting something, and it may not be in cash value and money value. There's other things. There's political favors going on. There's more weaponry or some kind of special thing that he wants or whatever it is. There's more money for more cars, better cars, newer cars. There's all kinds of stuff and payoffs going on. He's going to hang out with the pals. He's not going to go with you. He's not going to do it. But if you can change his point of view of empowerment, because you see what he's getting there is empowerment, okay? Now, if you could change his point of view, you're not coming in asking for anything. You're not attacking him on any level. You're not trying to change his thinking. You're just trying to have a relationship, and you're sharing information, and you're asking him for help, okay? And yet he sees you as an organization that is building a power and authority, and as the people in a formal way. You know, you've got, again, you put together a charter. You got a charter there. You got a resolutions, and he sees that they're pretty good. These are good things. Yeah, I can see we got to protect ourselves. Yeah, we can be coming. He's going to appreciate the fact that, yeah, we can come into an economic downfall in such a way that's going to be very destructive. And, yeah, I'd like to be in charge and make sure. And he's got to understand. He's got to make sure that this Constitution is still there at the end of this whole thing and during the whole thing. You see, it's a whole new approach. Now he's got two things in his hands, one on the right and one on the left. And, yeah, now he's got to make a decision. He's more apt to make the right decision if you do it this way. The other way, you'll never turn him. You're not going to change his spots. That's got to happen on his own.
So if he's choosing Babel, if he's choosing Babel right now, because my son worked there at Pennington County Jail as a jailer, and he left because they got money and they kept those people in jail, and he gave them every way to Sunday to get those people out of jail, and he's not going to do it. He's going to keep them
there.
I'll
answer your question with a parable. I'm going to leave it here. If you want to remove the splinter out of your brother's eye, you first must remove the log out of your own. Okay? Now, that's what this is all about. You got to get rid of the beam, you know? And you got to deal with it from a different perspective. You're not going to... Look, we have to change people's thinking. Our entire country on every government level is corrupt. If you want to put in jail and punish every single person breaking the law, every municipality, every capital, the federal city will be ghost towns. There'll be nobody there. You'll have nobody down at your town board, because even in your town, they'll all be in jail. All the judges will be, they'll all be in jail. We have to turn the people's hearts. We've got to change the people's minds. You have to get to them from a different perspective. That's all we're saying. And it starts off with a olive branch. It starts off with a relationship and not an issue. If you're going to go to the sheriff with an issue, he may already have his mindset on thinking, you're not going to get nowhere. You're not going to be able to get your pry bar anywhere to get a wedge in. You're not going to be able to do it. But if you're not trying to wedge him up and you're not trying to change him, you're just trying to have a relationship with him. He's doing what he's doing. You're doing what you're doing. From the people, it's a whole different attitude. Try to understand the philosophy and the strategy here. One day he's then got to make the decision. You got to give him a different mindset to fall into. You got to share something different. Look, a church doesn't work for most people. A lot of these people go to church only because he's got constituents there. Or maybe that's what he was taught to do and he still is a crook. I know a lot of people go to church. I know a lot of people better off not going to church than those who are going to church. You know, so church means nothing in this whole process. And a lot of times with politicians, it's all about power. It's just getting more constituents. That's all it is. Look at Bush, who walked around with a Bible in the beginning. Remember that? I mean,
yeah.
Look at all these guys, the same thing. They just used it. I mean, the guy is evil as I don't know what, but there he is. Anyway, I hear what you're saying. We're doing our best from inside the courts out there, and I don't think you're going to – and we're going after that sheriff directly. If you heard our papers, we read our papers. We put his name in the paper. He's got a problem out there in his little clique out there, as far as his deputies are concerned, and his jail that he's responsible for. And he better fix it, because we're coming out.
Who's going to enforce
it? Well, we're going to find that out soon. We're going to find that out soon. It's a matter of – it's a struggle within the courts. It's truth against – it's light against darkness, ultimately, is what it is. They can only hide as long as they're in the cover of darkness. When they start to realize that the game is up, the jig is up, and the people are understanding, and they're starting to come out in numbers, and they're starting to bang on the doors, and we got the rakes and the sticks, and we're tired of this whole thing, and they realize that, that's when they're going to scramble and run. And they'll grab a hold at that point. A lot of them will grab the olive branch at that point if it's still available, and they'll turn on the others, and next thing you know, we'll flood the courts. Look, it's a matter of time. We're looking for the critical mass. We're looking for the pressure. You know, if you read your Bible, go to the example of Jericho. We talk about it all the time. we're just like the people going around the city of Jericho, and we're blowing the trumpet of truth. They got the wall of resistance. We're blowing the trumpet of the truth, and we're going to go around that wall and around that wall and around that wall and around that wall, and we're going to blow the truth and blow the truth. And the walls are going to vibrate. The walls are going to vibrate. The resistance is going to start to weaken. And next thing you know, the walls are going to fall. Because that's the way things work. Light is always the best cleanser for darkness. Always. You turn the lights on, darkness flees. No different here. These people can only do what they're doing in darkness. There's nobody in the courts watching them. Everybody's in the game. They're all getting a piece of action. And that's why they don't like people coming in pro se. That's why they don't like people coming in taking notes and watching and observing. That's why they don't like people coming in and arguing and debating and saying, no, that's wrong. They squash them like bugs, and they move on, and they're very successful out of it. But when you have 10, 20, 30, 40 people coming in, and you got 20, 30, 40, 50 people a day calling, and you got the papers going in, and they can no longer hold them back, and the pressure is on, something's got to give. And this ultimate battle is ultimately a war against the rulers of darkness anyway. You know, look, either God's going to bring them to judgment or not. And he's going to bring them to judgment now or later. I don't know. And if now is the time, then we're doing his will. We're doing his will as long as we're doing the right thing anyway, whether we're successful or not. But if this is the time, then we're partakers in that time as part of the judgment upon these people by bringing in the king of the court back into his court, the court of justice. So how it works. Critical mass is on its way.
Well, and I'm trying to understand the lesson that Brent's been given as well about the militia of the several states, because I've listened to all of them and got the book and got the common law book from Brent Winters and listened to his radio, and it's like calling up the militia whoever
it's
calls
not them. Time. It's not time.
So we
it
don't
is not
train
time.
It is
not time for the militia. This is not the day of the militia. Look, that's one of the mistakes that that a lot of the Oath Keepers have made, and I think it's the main leadership, not the people themselves, that the main leadership has made the mistake of saying we've exhausted everything else. It's time to prepare for war, and they're more hardcore on that process. No, there's still time for peace. There's still time to do other things. We need to do the other things. So let's do them. But the militia comes and builds up its power and authority through the committees of safety. That's how it happened in the beginning of our nation. That's how it mustered together. It's through the committees of safety. That's how the militia started to become strong. Benjamin Franklin was a big pusher of that. And Jefferson and others. Okay. So this whole thing and this whole movement began because of the committees of safety. We will be fusing together because we are the militia. And we're working with the sheriff. The whole thing will come together. Anyway, we could talk some more next time. We're like 10 minutes over,
but I
stayed because it was a good, subject matter to discuss and try to explain to people. So,
I learned a lot. God bless you. Thank
appreciate
you so
it.
Much.
Let's talk some more on it because I think there's more to say on it, okay?
Okay.
All right, thanks everybody for coming. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And don't forget Thursday, where we get together Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to try to gather together and get more organization across the nation. All right, good night, everybody. Thanks for coming.